savings based on an employee price of $18,382 with $1,000 bonus cash and $1,500 employee advantage bonus cash. MSRP excludes tax. See dealer for delayed payment details. Not all buyers will qualify. Interest accrues from date of purchase. You must take retail delivery from dealer stock by October 3rd. Chrysler and Jeep are registered trademarks of Daimler Chrysler.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. A pleasure to be with you. We did the show last week, but I've been in New York City most of the week, so it feels like I've been gone forever. It used to take me about, I don't know, a week or 10 days before I sort of slaked the Motor City out of my consciousness and what have you. But increasingly, it seems like it's more like 7 to 10 hours or something like that. So after a while, I was in New York for about 4 days, and all of a sudden I'm thinking, Detroit. Do I really live there? Well, it is way beyond me. This is the second time this year I've been in New York City, and went there for a family get-together, although I'm not from New York. We just all met there, and I actually was, you know, there's so much incredible stuff there. I mean, it's just overwhelmingly. But I know, and excuse me, I know some of you are listening in the New York area, and some of you probably live or love New York like I do. But at the risk of sounding like a hick, you know, it's the old cliche. It's a nice place to visit, but I don't know how people live there. It is so noisy. It is so dirty. And believe me, all of that has really gotten better. Over the last 10 or 15 years, it is actually cleaner. It is quieter. The Central Park has just been rehabilitated in a way I think a lot of people thought was impossible. A lot of crime there. Remember, a lot of murders went on and all that. And myself, my family and friends, we were there on Saturday morning and just walking through it. And, I mean, there, of course, where there's space and there's greenery and there's water and there's nice restaurants in the park itself, it just seemed like everything was fine. But I always get this sense that, pardon me, that, in fact, friends of mine, in fact, if you're listening, Sandy and Terry, excuse me, who I love dearly and are just the most gracious hosts, but the idea of living in a building and then taking the elevator down and then going to the subway and going in this tube underground and then getting out and going to this big building and going to work, whew, I don't know. But they love it, and I'm glad they do, and I'm glad that they were kind enough to invite us as their guests. But and also, the street life is absolutely incredible. So there's just hundreds of thousands of people on the street at all times, which is very cool, very, very cool. But then I started thinking, what about the winter? What do they do in the winter? You can't hang out outside. You can't all these bars and restaurants with these open fronts and all that. All right, we're not here to talk about my travels, nor bars, nor New York City, or what have you, although I think we'll entertain almost any subject. 313-298-WRIF. The show's called Night Call. I'm Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E. That's W-E-R-B-E. Put .com after it. PeterWerby.com, you have my website. And I wanted to emphasize that because somebody wrote in and they were saying, Dear Mr., what was it, Werzy, or, you know, I had some odd spelling in my name, which I don't care. But I just want you to be able to, like, get a hold of me properly. Our email is calltalkyes@yahoo.com, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. So if you want to send a message, short message and say, I agree, I don't agree, I think you're great, I think you're an idiot, send it along. And if it's short, I'll probably read it. Sometimes, and I can tell, you know, sometimes some of you send me maybe 1,000 or 1,200 words, and I know how heartfelt this is, and I know how much thought and emotional energy and intellectual energy goes into the messages, because I know when I write what it takes. It's one thing to say, you haven't thought about the blah, 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 you know, why don't you do-do-do-do like that? Well, that doesn't take much thought. It does. There's got to be something in back of it. But I can't read real long ones till tomorrow. If I open it up and you've got like six paragraphs, I just kind of shunt that aside and look at it tomorrow. So if you want to comment on the show through email, please send a short one. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. All right, big anti-war demonstrations all across the country. Now, they didn't get extraordinary, although they were kind of up in the lead, if you look at least on the Internet. On Yahoo and MSNBC and stuff like that. They were in, you know, they have little packets. Of course, they're still leading with the catastrophe. And I'm not making any criticism of that. But I don't know. I mean, they... Well, let's just hope that there's not a third one waiting out there in the Caribbean. Bush has finally said they're going to examine all the disaster responses for all the cities, which is pretty good, I'd say. Maybe it's one of these barn, what do they say, at the close the barn door after the horse is stolen. And that's happened twice now, because although there was early response, of course, the evacuation of Houston was just absolutely dreadful. Can you imagine all of us trying to get out of Detroit because there's a big chemical spill or something like that? So these folks, in the modern world with all the possibilities of catastrophe, since we are giving them tens of billions of dollars and they've spent hundreds of billions of dollars on this joke called the Homeland Security Department, could you please at least work something out where we can easily, and understand it's a big undertaking and it takes a lot of planning, could we get out of the cities if we have to, and are there facilities through which to deal with people? I don't want to go to, I don't want to spend a few weeks in the Silver Dome. If you're not from the Detroit area, that's a big stadium like the Astrodome or the Superdome. So some people really kind of shook the Bush machine up, but they just don't have the people in there. I mean, this remember this Mike Brown, who was head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA? Brownie? You're doing a good job, Brownie. What was he? You're doing a heck of a job, Brownie. Well, that's the kind of corruption and nepotism. Nepotism is where you give jobs to your relatives or friends. Well, the corruption and the nepotism is so rampant in Bushco that all you got to do is know somebody from college or what have you, and there's all these positions empty in all these departments. And people, the professionals in government that were there under Ronald Reagan, some of them, the older men and women, and then under Bush 1 and then under Clinton, that were professional. They don't, whoever's president, they're professionals. They stay in there. They're quitting by the droves because every department has been politicized in this right-wing manner. And this is the intention of the Bush right-wing revolution, you see the results of it all, of ideology trumping common sense, of religious, right-wing religious fervor replacing what needs to be done, and on like that. All right, but let's talk a little about these anti-war demonstrations and why they're important. Because now we're at a point where, talking about reading Katrina, although there are tremendous issues, when we're just talking about, everybody talks about the weather, but there's nothing you can do about it. It's not entirely true anymore, because there's a very, very good essay on my website by Ralph Nader called, I don't have the website in front of me, peterwerby.com, but it talks about how the corporations are running away with it all, and how this is politically, it's done terrible damage to Bush, and well that it should, and yet this does fit the larger agenda. It does fit the larger agenda of having to cut social programs, of funneling more and more of our tax dollars to the corporations, suspending, right? Suspending environmental rules and suspending pay rules, suspending hiring rules, all of that. So that part of it's working well. All right, so let's just go through some of these, some of the material that has reported to us about the demonstrations. Now, there's two things. If you look at the word, you say demonstration or, well, let's just say demonstration. You say demonstration, what is that? It then, if someone said, describe what a demonstration is, it would be people with picket signs and people that are always going, Bush, you want a Bush, 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 B I mean, kind of incoherent, and unless you're really focusing on it or you're part of the sort of subset in America that is resisting this illegitimate authority that is coming out of Washington and incompetent. What is a lot of people have been calling the lethal combination of arrogance and incompetence, and what that has resulted in the economy and in Iraq and in New Orleans and all that. But they don't have the same social standing as the calm guys in the $3,000 suits. They have suits that cost, these guys wear suits that much, yeah. And that explain things in very calm manner, and they spend, like Bush when he was in New Orleans. Actually, he didn't have a suit on, and you can always tell he's going to get down, rolling up his sleeves. But yeah, they spend tens of thousands of dollars, or probably more, if you think about all that it costs for him to go to New Orleans and make a speech, and it's all lit properly. I mean, one of the people that that I was having dinner with in New York was who does professional lighting for theater, and we were talking about that and what's involved and the image that you are trying to create through lighting. Now, of course, you want that if you're seeing theater or opera or rock or what have you. I mean, we're thrilled by that, and it has a tremendous impact, and it can actually pump up. It can pump up the experience. Well, we don't want that when it comes to politics, because their idea is to still our minds, to put the critical side of our brain to sleep. Some of you may know who Albert Speer is. He was Hitler's architect, and he also created what were called the Nuremberg rallies. It was in the city of Nuremberg, and they designed, in some ways, the first mass propaganda rallies, because the voice was amplified. Remember, this is 30, so this is just starting, and that he would bring, he, Speer, Hitler's architect, would bring these enormous searchlights and put people within them and create what Speer called a cathedral of ice. And what it had the function of was to diminish the individual to simply this component part of the state that had no capacity to speak back to power. The ultimate leader stands created as this image of total power, and you as this single element of total submission. So we don't want that, because that doesn't have anything to do with a democratic society. That has something to do with a fascistic society. And when you start having the beginnings of that with people who are, you know, beginning to manipulate our mind through how we can light a speech. What are you talking about, man? Yeah, there's nothing like that. But it's a mindset that doesn't say we're going to have a discourse based on discussion of policy issues. It's how can we manipulate people into accepting our view. Extraordinarily dangerous. All right. So on one hand, you have our tax dollars flying Bush around, putting him where he doesn't have to be to make a speech, lighting him, bringing in all the staff, generators, all of that, so he can make a speech to get himself out of the trouble that he put himself into. It has this reason, sense of reasonableness, of power, of officialness, whereas the rabble that turns out, no matter how many there are, the rabble that turns out for demonstrations simply serves to function as sort of good visuals, in a way, for the news, and also proof of this society's pluralism. Remember that from high school civics? Pluralism means a lot of views can take place. So this was, all the demonstrations were completely peaceful, and this shows what a democratic society you are. You have the guys in the ritzy suits speaking for power and as power, and on the other hand, you have the rabble. I mean, that's people like me and all that. We're out there going, George Bush, and then you have someone who's kind of, a mirror image on a lower level presenting all this. The news commentators, we're here in Washington today, and at least 100,000 opponents of George W. Bush's Iraq policy have assembled. And in the background, they go, like that. And even still, even though we're presented like that, the critics of the Bush administration, those people who think he's doing a crappy job, lied about Iraq, doesn't hold the same values that we do, and on and on and on like this, screwed up hurricane relief. We have actually convinced the majority of people, or people have figured it out for themselves, that this administration is one of the worst in American history. All right, so let's go back to the demonstrations. Let me. This is kind of, and excuse me if you don't need this. I mean, this is, in a sense, how to read the news. And you can comment. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werbe, and you can go to my website as well, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E.com. And I think this is important because the eye takes in things so quickly. I talked to a colleague of mine here at the radio station who I have great respect for, who very critical of Bush, very critical of the war. And he said, hey, there were those big demonstrations yesterday in Washington, right? And I said, yeah, and I had to miss them and told him why, because I was doing a family thing in New York, or I would have been there in Washington. And although I know there's things that happen in Detroit as well, or in Livonia, and all around the country. So if you have any reports on this, please give us a call at 313-298-WRIF, or how you viewed them, anything to do with this. All right, let me, I still haven't gotten to the meat of this. So here is the Yahoo News, actually from the Associated Press. And I've said before, I could take any set of facts and quotes and have it be essentially objective, and yet come out and skew it in a particular way. All right. Crowds opposed crowds. I love that. Crowds, not citizens, not, that the citizens have the right to assemble for redress of grievances. That's in the Constitution, right? Crowds. At least they didn't say mobs or anything like that. Crowds opposed to the war in Iraq surged. Who writes these? Don't these people have editors? I mean, all right. Crowds opposed. I don't even see that. I just see post-war, White House, Saturday. All right. Here, read this sentence. Crowds opposed to the war in Iraq surged past the White House on Saturday, shouting peace now in the largest anti-war protest in the nation's capital since the U.S. invasion. So none of that's untrue. It's all a crowd. I'm sure you could say surge is a synonym for walking or passing the White House and shouting peace now. So it gives that image, again, of something that makes a lot of people kind of nervous, right? There's too much energy there. People get frightened when things appear to have the capacity to go out of control. And if crowds are surging and shouting, that's just a step below something we all don't like. All right. The rally stretched through the day and into the night, a marathon of music, speech making, and dissent on the National Mall. Okay. Police Chief Charles H. Ramsey, noting that organizers had hoped to draw 100,000 people, said, I think they probably hit that. All right. So that's the figure that almost everybody. Oh, I didn't finish that story. So the colleague of mine says, oh, yeah, the right wing and the left wing kind of got into it. That's what he saw. So that's interesting. So we'll keep that in the back of your mind. So it just describes everybody. And, not a bad article. One sign said Bush lied, thousands died, and the occupation said another. They have quotes from a number of people, including a Republican. Now here's more. So you want to find out what's happening in the world, right? Thousands of people attended smaller rallies in cities on the West Coast, including Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco, and Seattle. Well, what does that tell you? Smaller ones, 20 people? I mean, someone wrote me and said I think there was like 63 people in Livonia. So you say, well, 50,000 people came out in some of these cities on the West Coast. That's in an individual city. This wasn't like a magnet demonstration. People here went on buses, went on buses and from Detroit and trains and flew and drove. These are people in Los Angeles. We're going to have someone report to us from Los Angeles in just a little while. Okay, so right all of a sudden, it says in Washington, a few hundred people in a counter-demonstration in support of Bush's Iraq policies lined the protest route. The two groups shouted at each other. A police line kept them apart. But then at the end, it ends with a 150 supporters of Bush's policy. Now, that's pretty minuscule. 150 people. Now, these people, and I'm not going to give their names because the names of the groups, because the mass media is doing this all the time. So these people were funded, these right-wingers, these pro-Bush, last holdouts who, in many ways, manipulated a lot of the grief and anger of these people who had lost children in the Iraq War, and got them to these rallies, telling them there was going to be 10 and 20,000 people at them. Well, 150 people show up. So the police chief says they'd hoped that, or actually the narrative says, noting that organizers had hoped to draw 100,000. So let's leave it at 100,000 right there. There's 100,000 anti-war demonstrators and 150 of these right-wingers. And they end the article's quote with something from one of the right-wingers. If you bring them home now, talking about the troops, who's going to be responsible for all the atrocities that are fixing to happen over there? Cindy Sheehan? Well, I mean, that's such a pack of non sequiturs, you know, the stuff that doesn't follow one from the other. It's hopeless even to try to figure that one out. But it's interesting that in an article about an anti-war march that brings at a minimum of 100,000, they end the article with a pro-war quote from a right-winger that only managed to bring 150 people. There's probably 500 people waiting in the Portageon lines across the street. So they're outnumbered by the people they got to take a whiz that are opposed to the war, that came there from all over. And these people who had the same deal, they had buses, they had these tour buses, and they couldn't bring together more than 150 people. All right, so where did they get the figure 100,000? C-SPAN said 500,000. Yeah, I'm just getting an email here from Joel's listening in Indiana, Pennsylvania. Well, that's what it says. Peter, there were more than 300,000 people in D.C. People I talked to from D.C. and who are experienced with crowds at these events said it was the largest one they'd ever seen. All right. The organizers are saying there's 300,000. Well, everybody, you know, always exaggerates. That's what someone said to me today at breakfast. I said, where's the proof of that? He looked at me. He said, well, they always do. I said, well, give me an instance where demonstrators have exaggerated the number of people that have attended these things. Well, here's the way it started. This was from Thursday, September 22nd. Again, Associated Press. Is this the same person? Yeah, Jennifer C. Kerr. And she's such an awful writer. This would never get, I mean, I used to write a lot for the Metro Times. This would never get by a Metro Times editor. They got great editors. All right, here. Anti-war groups are using a $1 million ad campaign and a demonstration they say will attract 100,000 people to try to energize their movement. Well, try to re-energize their movement. Well, it doesn't seem that it needs re-energizing. It's really energized to begin with. But secondly, it says they say will attract 100,000. Well, where could I get the citation for that? Where did someone say that? You know, one of the key rules in writing like this is that you're supposed to show, not tell. So in other words, you have to have Leslie Kagan, for instance, who is the chief organizer for United for Peace and Justice, say, we expect 100,000. Well, I know this is crap, because as a matter of policy, no organizer is ever going to say, we are going to get X number. Because if it's too high, you know, say they said we're going to get 1 million people and all they got was 400,000, which would be a tremendous amount, they'd say well below the expectations of organizers. So they don't ever say anything. And they're certainly not going to say 100,000, because I knew in my bones, there was just from all the buzz, that there was going to be a couple 300,000 there. So where they picked this up from, and then it just circulates within the mass media, is that they applied, the groups that were holding the anti-war demonstration applied for a permit saying we'll have 100,000. I mean, they didn't think that was going to be there. They have that sort of a pro forma thing. So that just continues on. Bush did not plan to be in Washington on Saturday, but he'll have support on the street. The groups, and he names two of them, plan their own demonstration on Saturday. Let's see. The spokesman says, we made a vow after September 11th that we'd not allow the anti-American left to do to us this time what they did during Vietnam. Yeah, like what? Yeah, you're right. Stop the war. Well, these creeps, by the way, are all drafty. They're not, the military age, and they want, not one of them want to, do that. Go put their essentially their bodies where their mouths are. They want someone else to take the heat. They want other people to go over and kill and be killed, right? They don't want to be one of the almost 2,000 people that have died on this side and 15,000 with critical injuries. Anyway, so the, today, Associated Press said, support for U.S. troops fighting abroad mixed with anger towards anti-war demonstrators at home as hundreds of people, far fewer than organizers had expected, rallied on the National Mall. Because they did make the fatal mistake. These pathetic right-wing losers said there was going to be 10 to 20,000 people. They had unlimited amounts of money. They had these pro-war tour buses that were following Cindy Sheehan's path and what have you. And that's what they got out, about 400 people. You know, they don't you think they have 100 organizers in this group, maybe? So they got four people out for every organizer. They even got a Republican senator, Jeff Sessions of Alabama. The group who spoke here the other day did not represent the American ideals of freedom, liberty, and spreading that around the world. Well, it was a big group. Your little group couldn't even get together 500. And they have signs like, arrest the traitors. See, this is fascism. You disagree with the government, arrest them. And in fact, you can... You know, sometimes these right-wingers will walk in the middle of a anti-war demonstration because they know no one's going to do anything to them. Yeah, you know, because we are peaceful people. But here's what their sign said. You shut the hell up. We'll protect civilization. So they don't believe in the Constitution. All right, I've been talking way too long, haven't I? My apologies, dear friends, and I could go on endlessly. I know you believe that. All right, let's take some of our calls. I can't tell from the spelling of this name. Is it Marilyn?
Marion,
okay. It was a good guess at it by Jay Hudson, or I'm embarrassing him, our producer. Hi, Marion. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, hi, Peter. I was just wanted to interject a little thought that maybe if we get the House in 2006, if the Democrats get it, we can impeach him.
Well,
what do you say?
I don't know. I mean, the Republicans are like bulldogs. For instance, the way they went after Clinton on something extraordinarily minor. But I don't think that the Democrats are up to the job. What do you think?
I don't know. It seems like the Congressional Black Caucus are the only ones that have any balls.
Well,
they're the only ones that seem to be standing up to these idiots.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what happens between now and November 2006. It suddenly seems like an extraordinarily long way away. What other catastrophes can strike this country in the meantime? It's scary.
God help us.
All right. Thank you, Marion. I appreciate it. Here's Aaron in Monroe. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
I just got back from the military. I'm a recent separated veteran, and I had the luxury of tuning into you tonight. I didn't know there was a good radio show out there so influenced on politics and everything.
Go ahead. What do you think?
Honestly, to where you're going to, like, through with the protesters a few minutes ago, it's unbelievable, like, with the amount of, complete catastrophes we've had in this country recently, along with our pending wars, Iraq, Afghanistan, possibly a war with North Korea, and, you know, and we still have troops in Bosnia and this and that, and... You know, with Bush in office, I mean, I can't imagine a better person right now. With all these things going on, if Clinton had been in office, I don't know how my tour would have been.
What do you mean your tour? I mean, what do you mean by how your tour would have been?
Well, I think that, like, if Clinton had been in office, it would have been a lot worse off. Obviously, FEMA made some terrible mistakes. Come, you know, the hurricanes and this and that. And
yeah.
But we learn from our mistakes, and we try to go farther with them.
Well, it doesn't seem like Bush learned much from 9/11. I mean, they've spent hundreds of billions of dollars of our tax dollars preparing for catastrophes, and then Bush, who admitted responsibility, by the way, this isn't up for opinion anymore, he said that the fact that the government was late, he takes the responsibility. The fact that there was so much incredible damage and loss of life, I don't know what penalty he pays. But, it's sort of a weird construction, Aaron, to talk about if Clinton would have been president, because he wasn't. And there is only one person who is sitting in the Oval Office. And it seems like he's driven us into a disastrous war that gets worse every single day. Were you in Iraq?
I did my part from the Navy, actually.
Okay.
I did what I could to keep the aircraft in the air to deliver ordnance.
Well, you wouldn't have noticed any different no matter who was there.
Well, obviously I wasn't on land. I tried to be, but, that's a whole different story. As far as Bush is concerned, though, I think good on him for admitting responsibility and trying to work with it.
Yeah, but what happens if you make mistakes of such a catastrophic nature and you say, I admit responsibility? But isn't there penalties that go with taking the responsibility when there are such bad results? I mean, shouldn't the guy, resign? I mean, if I screwed up that badly, both on 9/11 and on this and on the economy and on Iraq, why the hell is he still in office? All right. Well, you think about that one. I'm going to move on in the meantime. Let's see. Here is Jerry in Detroit. Jerry, hi. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going? At last, I finally made it.
Oh, good. Welcome.
All right. I watched both of the rallies.
Uh-huh.
And I noticed a big difference, especially with the pro-war rally I saw.
Yeah.
They devoted the entire 4.5 hours to bashing Cindy Sheehan, and two on always invoking 9/11, even though it had nothing to do with Iraq.
Uh-huh.
Because you know how they always claim that, every time when they mention Iraq, they always mention, remember the Twin Towers. And
yeah.
But a lot of that was spurred on primarily by right-wing talk radio, which, of course, had a few of their people on speaking up there. Mostly they were attacking Cindy Sheehan.
You know, that's so crazy. I mean, that's generally what they do. I heard this... what's his name? Christopher Hitchens, who was kind of a leftist, and now he's a big supporter of Bush. And he was on the Bill Maher show with George Galloway, this member of Parliament for Britain, who has written a book and was over here. And it's all that Hitchens did was kept attacking the person. Remember, that's the logical fallacy with the Latin phrase ad hominem. Actually, attack the man. You don't say you don't attack the argument, you attack the man. And these right wingers that you probably noticed, Jerry, that they are frothers. I mean, they are frothing at the mouth because their whole insane house of cards is beginning to tumble down.
And on top of that, the biggest myth they keep perpetuating is that if you oppose the war, you oppose the troops, you're un-American, unpatriotic, traitorous, that sort of thing.
Well, I don't even know why they get any credence, because that kind of blather has always come out of the mouth of conservatives. And, at first it works, but it didn't work in around Vietnam. It didn't work. I mean, when you begin to look back at the questionable wars in the United States, like Vietnam, like Panama, like Grenada. I mean, Grenada hasn't been exposed that much, but like World War I, the Mexican War, the Spanish-American War, it always comes out that everything that the critics said, whether it was Mark Twain in 1898 or, anti-war demonstrators in Vietnam, everything they said turned out to be absolutely true.
In Iraq, as far as the Iraq war, see, they're trying to do just about everything short of sending out the Remember in Vietnam they sent out the hard hats, the construction workers to beat up the anti-war protesters?
Yeah.
I have a feeling if this keeps up, they're going to start doing that, too, with the anti-war protesters today.
Well, Jerry, they don't have anybody to send out. They spent hundreds of thousands of dollars and wound up with the ability to bring out about 400 people for a national rally. I mean, I can't remember exactly what I said on my website, but these are pathetic losers, these right-wingers, these pro-war people. They've got no support, and the people that do support them won't even come out of their houses. All right, thank you very much, Jerry. I got to take a break. We will be right back to get your calls. 313-298-WRIF.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. Another WRIF concert. System of a Down live. System of a Down, this Thursday night, Joe Louis Arena. Their new album, Mesmerize, in stores now.
Everybody's going to the party, have a real good time.
With special guest, the Mars Volta. System of a Down and the Mars Volta. This Thursday night, Joe Louis Arena. System of a Down and the Mars Volta. Don't miss it. Get your tickets on sale right now at all Ticketmaster locations, the venue box office, or log on to cellardoor.com. System of a Down live.
A message from the Red Robin Office of Enjoyment.
Hey, it's Rudy. You know, Red Robin's Chili Chili Cheeseburger is a big, juicy beef patty served open-faced with chipotle mayo, cheddar cheese, and diced red onions, and smothered with our meaty homemade chili chili. So my assistant Jake and I are promoting it here at a chili cook-off.
And we're going to make everyone wish you never made...
Okay, Jake.
Sorry.
Red Robin.
Yum. The Chili's cooking at Red Robin in Livonia, Brighton, and Pittsfield Township.
A message from the Red Robin Office of Enjoyment.
Hey, it's Rudy.
And Jake.
And we're here at a chili cook-off promoting Red Robin's Chili Chili Cheese Fries. They're crispy golden steak fries covered in melted cheddar cheese and our homemade chili chili.
Hey, Rudy, check it out. I made a 6-foot Red Robin steak fry.
Well, where's the chili and melted cheese?
I was kind of hoping you wouldn't notice.
Red Robin.
Yum. Looking for chili perfection? Visit Red Robin in Clinton Township or Roseville.
Hello, my name is Dr. Kambadi with the Lake Laser Eye Center, where I treat you personally from the minute you walk through the door to the moment you leave with excellent vision. Recently, we asked WRIF to help get our message out to the public. We have had great success using WRIF, and this is why. Steve, my account manager, took the time to visit my facility and see firsthand what makes us different from the competition. He then made the proper marketing recommendation for my business. I'm glad they were able to see that I'm a hands-on doctor that treats everyone myself from beginning to end. They properly deliver that message. I think the staff here is great, and now I feel like a true part of the RIF family.
Hi, I'm Steve DeBruzen from RIF Sales. RIF doesn't just rock. RIF works for your business. Call me today at 248-591-6826.
Hi, I'm Al Devey, and at both of our dealerships, we want every customer to have the best experience available in southeastern Michigan. It starts with price, and our position on price is very simple. We will beat any purchase or lease price on a new Dodge, guaranteed. Right now, I can put you into a brand new 2005 Dodge Ram 1500 Quad Cab 4x4 for only $89 a month. Or how about a 2005 Durango 4x4, just $99 a month? And we'll make it easy for you. We'll deliver your new or used vehicle to your home, work, or anywhere. We're on Joseph Campo in Hamtramck and in Clarkston on Dixie Highway, exit 93, just north of I-75. And if you can't get in to see us, shop by phone. Call 866-ALDB.
Your hometown dealer and then bringing you the best. And they're bringing you the best because they're your hometown dealer. ALDB Dodge.
Special sale hours Monday through Thursday, 9 till 9, Friday 9 to 6, and Saturday 9 to 3. Sale ends Friday, September 30th. Check your local paper for details.
Ladies, some dessert today?
Okay.
I highly recommend the Diet Dr. Pepper. The flavor is divine.
That sounds good.
Frankly, I don't know why they even called it a diet.
How is that prepared?
We'll begin by gently pouring the rich, luscious Diet Dr. Pepper over ice cubes until the sweet, refreshing goodness rises to a golden halo of fizz.
Yum. Make it two.
With a flavor this rich and rewarding, there's nothing diet about it. It's not a diet. It's a Diet Dr. Pepper.
When you want big savings, Kroger delivers with another 10 for 10 sale. Right now, use your Plus Card and save on 16-ounce bags of Dole Classic Iceberg Salads at 10 for $10 and so much more. You'll also save on fresh Tyson Boneless Skinless Chicken Breasts at Buy One, Get One Free. And whole Boneless Beef Ribeyes at $3.99 a pound. Your neighborhood Kroger. Right store, right price.
I think I've lost them. Great, lose the bad guys, hit a fence. Better call insurance. 1-800-ESURANCE.
Go.
Hi, Agent Aaron here. I've gotten into a fender bender eluding my pursuers. But don't worry, I wasn't injured.
Well, Special Agent, look on the bright side. At least you've got insurance.
True, with insurance, I can report a claim anytime, 24-7, 365 days a year.
And don't forget, at insurance, there's always someone there to help.
With insurance's fast, friendly claims representatives, I'll be back on the road in no time.
That's right, Special Agent. Affordable rates, fast, friendly service, round-the-clock claims handling. That's insurance.
And that's why I always say, if you're on the go, you've got to have Esurance.
Save on 24-7 claim service at Esurance. Get your auto insurance quote at Esurance.com today.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to the program. Emails starting to come in. The lines are jammed. People want to comment on both the demonstrations that occurred. Some of the people that are waiting, some of the people that have sent emails were there. And as always, a dispute about numbers. I say, as usual, the media way lowballs it, and they give absolutely extraordinary coverage, unwarranted coverage to counter-demonstrators. So there was somewhere between what the media said, 100,000, and what C-SPAN, I guess that's the media, said, 500,000 people in Washington saying no to Bush's lying war in Iraq. Trying to figure it out is difficult. I was actually trying to get somebody from one of the groups that sponsored it, because they rent airplanes and then they take photographs of it. But I said, I said that at breakfast this morning, a friend of mine said, well, the demonstrators, they exaggerate too. And I said, well, what do you mean? I never saw that. And he said, well, they do. And I said, tell me. I don't see it. And so I get this email from, I won't even mention his name. It says, low blow. Peter, I don't think my response to you was the dumb, gee, I don't know type that you portrayed on your show. I know it's only showbiz, but Peter, all right, so I'm sorry, I didn't mean to hurt your feelings, but I don't think you came up with any examples. All right, more email quickly. Kim from Dearborn Heights wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. She says, or he says, Kim can be either one. I think it's, I don't know. Anyway, the march was huge. I've been to many marches, and that was the largest I can recall. And why are people paying so much attention to this little infinitesimal handful of right-wing wackos that come out there? Because she talks a few, quotes them and all that. All right. This I like. I also wonder what the college Republicans were doing in Washington rather than Baghdad, which of course is true, because these warmongers, what they really are, they want you to go to Iraq. They want, and some of you have been, but they don't want to go because, like they're the people of their parents' generation, the Bushes and the Cheney. Cheney said about the war in Vietnam, I have better things to do, I have other priorities. Wasn't that? I have other priorities. And you go down the list of Republicans, it's uncanny. absolutely uncanny how they have been able to portray themselves as, the militarists, where it's the Democrats who all have military service, all have medals, all of that. And every one of these Republicans are what they call a chicken hawk. In fact, if you want to have some fun and you don't know about this, Google chicken hawk and see what you get. Well, this is good. This is Roy in Placidas, New Mexico. He listens on the Internet. He says, Peter, we probably had 500-plus people at the demonstration in Albuquerque yesterday. The crowd extended three blocks as they marched on the sidewalk from Kirkland Air Force Base to the demonstration site on a closed-off street to a Walmart parking lot. Two unmarked police cars monitored the march at one point, cautioning the peacekeeper crowd monitors to make sure the folks stayed out of the street. All right, whatever. They will do that. Right, let's go to this is Mohammed in Dearborn. Mohammed, welcome to the show. It's Peter Werby.
Hey, sorry about that, Peter. Hey, how you doing, Peter?
I'm doing great. Thanks for calling.
Love your show, my man. Love it.
Thank you.
Man. I've been like watching a lot of the protesting on war, and my parents got a satellite, so we get all the Arabic channels over there too, and they've been covering that a lot too. And I'm just saying, because you said a lot of the, well, not too many of the right-wing people that were in favor of the war were there. To play the devil's advocate right now, don't you think it's a little harder to, like, you know, sort of like counterpart a protest, you know, because you're like trying to one-up them when they've been organizing, like the anti-war people have been organizing this for a while, and the pro-war people just hear about it. And then they try, you know, sort of like...
Well, you're... Well, for one thing, Mohammed, the devil's got enough advocates, but be that what it may. They were organizing... I just refuse to give these people any more publicity because... But if you went to their website, they were talking about... They were saying they were going to have 10 to 20,000 people. They were talking about... They had groups in all these cities that they were... going on, that they were preparing for months to counter this demonstration. So they had about equal opportunity to do so. But people aren't coming out. Very few people came out, much, much less than expected, for that Sunday, September 11th pro-war rally that the Pentagon put on, where it was going to be this march that was supposed to memorialize the September 11th victims and support the troops. Again, I mean, this is typical Secretary of War Rumsfeld conjoining these two events, September 11th and the war in Iraq, which he's in great part responsible for putting this kind of nonsense into the public debate. So they had every opportunity, but, I mean, whatever. I mean, they had to, but today, Sunday, Mohammed, this was the day that they were supposed to have their own demonstration, and they had a United States senator was going to speak, and they said, we're going to have 10 to 20,000 people, and they had 400. So they are such a dismal flop beyond any expectation. I mean, I'm almost fearful that we're going to read tomorrow that there has been, like, mass suicides. I mean, if I had spent that amount of time, if I had had those great expectations, if I hated the people of the other side with the intensity that they do, that make them into the devil, that demonize them, and 400 people came out. There must have been 100 of them organizers. All right. Thank you, Mohammed. I appreciate it. Thanks for calling in. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Eric from Wyandotte. Hi, Eric. It's Peter. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Doing good.
First of all, I'd like to thank the man from Monroe for serving for us. You said earlier that it was the president's fault for the economic crisis, when really it's the people of America that's the problem, because when something happens and they start to run away and they don't spend their money, which makes prices go higher because nobody wants to buy anything.
Well, prices, wait a minute, Eric, where are you bringing this up from? The prices, there hasn't been inflation. The problem is that that because of these tax breaks for the ultra wealthy instead of for people like you and me, we've taken all these economic hits, and actually our wages are either stagnant or falling, and we're all this money that should have gone to the middle class and the working class wound up in the hands of the ultra wealthy. We don't have enough money to finance the government, so we're debtors now. And I don't know how old you are, but if you're in your 20s, you're going to be paying for this for another 40 years. If you're older, your kids are going to be paying for it, and your grandkids are going to be paying for this.
I'm 18. Since President Bush has been in office. My mother has been more well off. She's more of a middle to lower class, and she has been able to be able to take care of myself and my sister, and now I have another sister, and we're better off now than we would have been if Al Gore had won, because...
Well, you don't know that. And here, listen, I actually have been better off since George Bush has been in office. I'm not saying that everyone's fate and fortune has dropped off. You have to have look at some aggregate totals of the economy. And the wealthy are getting wealthier. The poor, there's more and more poor people under Bush, more and more people without health insurance. And if you just look at it from your own circumstances, I mean, I should become a Republican and say, well, wait a minute. Suddenly I'm making more money. Suddenly I had the ability to do this and that and consume this. So things must be all right in the world because I've got more money. Doesn't make a bit of sense. I mean, come on, we got to look at the larger picture. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call, Joe from Detroit. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Pete. I wanted to talk about Detroit.
Sure.
I ran for city council here in Detroit this year.
Did you win?
I did not. I did not get past the primary, I'm sorry to say.
If you're a public person and feel like it, feel free to mention your last name.
Joe Holt. I don't know how public I am, but we did meet at the anniversary party for the 5th Estate last year.
Oh, yeah, I remember that, sure.
You told me not to run, but I did anyway. The last 2 weeks, they've had a recount down at Cobo Hall.
Yeah.
And Maureen Taylor paid some money to look at some of the different ballot boxes. 29 out of the 46 that she wanted to recount were uncountable, either because of errors in the books, too many ballots, not enough ballots. All kinds of different problems where you can't count the ballots, seals that were missing, seal numbers that were changed. You know, we don't have to be in Florida for people to steal elections.
Well,
and even if they're not stealing elections, there's some incompetence involved.
Well, so what do we take from that? I mean, there's got to be massive electoral reform. I mean, it is bordering. Actually, I wouldn't say bordering. It is absolutely ridiculous how many people are denied the ballot in this country. I mean, one of the things that has to be done is some uniform ballot. I mean, I think without fear of... without any fear of being wrong, that Bush was actually put into office twice by ballot manipulations.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, we'll never know the truth, and that's the most unfortunate thing. Whether we're right or they're right, they've got the office.
You know what?
So it's kind of hard to disprove them. They've got all the proof.
They do. Well, here is something that, and someone's going to have to call in and tell me about this, because I was in New York all this week and didn't get a chance to look at material the way I did, but there was just this ballot study that came out with President Carter and someone else called the Carter something or other study. Did you see that?
I did not.
Okay, well, someone can remind us. I'm sure they did. And Carter, I saw something that said Carter said which one? Now, see, I don't want to make a wrong statement. I'm not a right winger. If I was a right wing commentator, I'd say whatever the hell I felt like that supported my position. But I think he might have said that he thought that that Kerry had won the 2004 election. Maybe, but someone maybe should call up, make sure I'm not just talking out of my head.
Well, I am proud to say that my mom, several of my sisters, and her brother-in-law went to Washington for the Peace March.
Great.
And let's hope something comes of that. When's the next big mobilization? November 2nd?
I think it is, yeah. Well, I'll tell you one thing, Joe. When we stop getting beyond the numbers game, what we used to say in the big demonstrations in the bygone era was the most important days of the demonstration was the day before and the day after, meaning what sort of organizing did we do to bring people the information that would make them feel committed enough to come out to a demonstration. And then you'd have the demonstration, and then you would have the day after. What was remaining? I mean, was it just disperse? All right, sir, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Better luck next time for the Detroit City Council. Let's see here. Jason's in Livonia. Hi, Jason. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. This is Jason from Livonia.
Hi.
And I was calling just because I'd like to talk with you regarding your premise that, you know, all wars are unnecessary. You know, in a perfect world, there would...
Where did you get this as my premise?
Well, you know, you said the Vietnam War was a criminal war.
I didn't say it was a criminal war, but I think it was an illegal. We used to have a thing called the Constitution where it says only Congress shall declare war, but these police actions began. And, of course, it was based on a lie, and this was a Democratic president that made up this lie that the United States was attacked by North Vietnamese ships. Nobody disputes that anymore. So our country was responsible for killing 3 million Indochinese citizens and wound up getting 60,000 of our soldiers killed and hundreds of thousands wounded and addicted to drugs. Didn't seem like a real good idea, in retrospect particularly.
Well, Peter, you kind of cut me off there.
I did. I did indeed.
But what I was trying to say is what happened after we left and, you know, the Khmer Rouge that came in. How about World War II? Was that not a...
Wait, I don't know what you mean. I actually don't understand your point. I specifically mentioned wars in which there was great dispute among the population. That was the Mexican War, which was a pure imperial land grab, which stole the huge sections of another country for this idea of manifest destiny that these people running things had. And it was opposed by people like Henry David Thoreau and others. I was talking about, and the same thing accrued to the Spanish-American War, another thing based totally on a lie that the Spanish had bombed a ship in Maine Harbor, and the hysteria was whipped up by the Hearst Press of the time, and there were critics like Mark Twain and others who said this was just an imperialist war. You know what? I usually don't hold people over breaks. Hold on, though, because I have to do these commercials before 12 o'clock here, and we'll get back to you.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
Summer may be winding down, but the party is on at Walker Speakeasy. You know that Walker Speakeasy is the only place on the west side to entertain you all week long. Conveniently located at the corner of Beach Daily and Joy Roads in Dearborn Heights, just south of I-96. Featuring an awesome new menu, Walker Speakeasy is always open for lunch and dinner. Enjoy a whole lot of eye candy every Wednesday night as Detroit's loveliest ladies compete in a very special bikini contest. Every Thursday, country meets southern rock as Detroit's own Yankeeville brings Redneck Thursdays to Walker's with no cover. Also featuring the sexy guest bartenders, the Untouchables. The Rock is always live on Fridays as Walker's presents Detroit's premier rock review every Friday night. This Friday, Red 57 takes the stage at Walker's. Call 313-274-9645 or visit Walker's online at www.walkerspeakeasy.com. Walker's Speakeasy. Have fun or leave.
Are you one of the 2 million adult Americans who have stuttered since childhood? Does your stuttering still interfere with talking to work associates, friends, or even family? Do you avoid social situations where your stuttering may become worse? If so, you may be interested in being evaluated for participation in a new research study of an investigational drug to see if it helps people with persistent developmental stuttering. Each qualified participant in this research study will receive all study-related medical care, including health assessments and study medication, at no charge. You're invited to call us about participation in this research study. Please call 1-866-289-1359. That's 1-866-289-1359. Or you may also visit the study website at www.stutteringstudy.com. That's www.stutteringstudy.com.
Consider yourself a music insider, huh? Well, then you should check this out. Be the first to get the inside scoop, discover the hottest bands, and get their latest downloads. All you need to do is log on to musicinthezone.com, brought to you by your friends at Old Spice. Musicinthezone.com lets you discover music on your own terms, exposing you to hot, cutting-edge music before it hits the radio. Log on now to enter to win one of 30 custom iPod minis, to learn about upcoming Music in the Zone events in your area, and much, much more. Find out about upcoming shows, get the story on cool new emerging acts, and receive download codes redeemable at iTunes for artists like Louis XIV, Big City Rock, The X's, and Cold. Log on to musicinthezone.com now to discover tomorrow's sounds today. Brought to you by your friends at Old Spice.
Media Play, Media Play the best, Media Play for less.
Media Play has taken a music store, movie store, bookstore, and video game store and created an entertainment superstore. You save time, you save money, you get everything you love in one place.
Media Play the best.
It's Media Play's half-price clearance. Get 50% off select items store-wide. Half-price CDs, half-price DVDs, half-price video games and books. This just in. Desperate Housewives and The Longest Yard on DVD. CDs from Bon Jovi and Disturbed. Plus, from your new Halloween headquarters. Costumes up to 40% off. 40% off.
Media Play. Media Play the best.
Get music, movies, games, and books. Get half-price hits. Get to Media Play's half-price clearance by Sunday.
Media Play.
Centerfold Lounge, Detroit's sexiest adult entertainment club, is celebrating their 20th anniversary. That's 20 years of hot ladies, rock and roll, and fun. Come celebrate with 20th anniversary specials, a complimentary buffet, buckets of beer for $20, and two for $20 dances. Take pleasure in great giveaways as you dance to the beats of the house DJ. Centerfold, with the greatest ladies, music, and light show. Bachelor and bachelorette parties are always welcome. NFL Sunday, Centerfold's opens at noon with great food, including pizza and wings, dollar drafts, and $3 bottles. Get there early to catch the game on the big screens. Centerfold Lounge opens 7 days a week at 2 p.m. on John R. One Block South of 8 Mile Road. Call 313-892-7333 for more details. Centerfold Lounge, 20th anniversary and NFL action. Football, buffets, hot ladies, rock and roll, and big specials.
Center of attraction.
Looking for a sugarless gum with great flavor that really lasts? Grab some Trident sugarless gum in a variety of delicious, long-lasting flavors like original and tropical twist that are sure to make you smile. Plus, Trident now comes in the new Easy Close Pack that's reclosable, so your gum stays in the pack right where it belongs. So you can take great, long-lasting flavor with you wherever you go. Pick up some Trident sugarless gum today in the new Easy Close Pack. Trident, a mouth's best friend.
Look for Trident sugarless gum in the new Easy Close Pack at your neighborhood Kroger store. You'll find everything you need for your family at Kroger. From the freshest meats and the farm fresh produce for family meals to handy snacks for when you're on the go. While you're at your favorite Kroger, don't forget to stock up on great tasting Trident sugarless gum. Great flavors and a cool new pack make Trident a mouth's best friend. So pick up Trident today at a store that makes shopping simple. Kroger, right store, right price.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. What am I looking for here? Did we do that already? Sorry. That's not a very good way to start an hour, because you should always start a new hour like it's a new show. We're not going to do that entirely, but if you've been listening for a while or haven't, I'll just recap it a little. We're talking about the big demonstrations that have occurred not only in Washington, D.C., but all around the country and all around the world. I got an email saying there was about 65 people in Livonia, Michigan, that there were 500 people in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And the disputed numbers, I think this is extraordinarily interesting. But I was talking with, continue to do so, with Jason in Livonia. And Jason was saying that my premise was that all wars were bad. And I think I've said that it's not. And let me just repeat what I said. The contested wars throughout United States history, the Mexican War, the Spanish-American War, the First World War, the Vietnam War, and some of Bush 1's little wars, it's turned out, when we look back in history, that the critics were always right, whether it was Henry David Thoreau during the Mexican War, whether it was Mark Twain during the Spanish-American War, whether it was the Socialists and the Unionists in World War I, whether it was the anti-war protesters during the Vietnam War. Everything that the critics said came true. Everything that they said was wrong with it turned out to be wrong. And that's happening right away with Iraq. All right, let's just finish the conversation with Jason. All right, Jason, so go ahead. After I said that, your response is what?
My response is, first, Vietnam was a legal war, but it wasn't a criminal war.
Well, no one mentioned anything about criminal. You brought up the stuff about criminal war.
Well, I guess what I would say is, you know, you got to look at the forest and not just the trees.
Well, how about if we look at the wars? Give me kind of...
I agree with you 100%, Peter. There were wars in the past, you know, where we had the wrong premise.
Yeah.
And Spanish-American War. You know, we grabbed the land from the Indians, and that's true.
Okay, so we all agree with it. What don't we agree on? Quickly.
I agree there is evil. And unfortunately, sometimes it's hard to believe that, being a good person, and I'm sure you're a good person.
There's bad people. Go ahead.
And there's bad people, right. And, I mean, you know, look how much money we spent developing the bomb in World War II. We spent all sorts of money.
Well, what does that have to do with what's going on now?
I mean, well, you're complaining about us deficit spending. I think we have a war, an ideological war going on.
Well, there's not much of an ideological war. We've got maybe a few thousand people that are activists in this so-called terror war. This allows for a continuation of a permanent war economy. We're spending 10 times more annually on a war budget than any other country in the world. I mean, the second one is China. We're spending $500 billion a year. No country in the history of the world has ever cut taxes for the rulers, for the ultra-wealthy, for the privilege in the midst of a war. This throws it all on us. There was a surplus. And if that would have continued along at that rate, at least Bush could have financed the war without deficit spending, but could have also done things like written a check for Katrina. Now we're screwed. Either we're, it's going to drive us deeper into deficit, but in the short run, Halliburton and the rest of them are going to make fortunes. You know, I got to take another call. In fact, it's a pleasure to welcome to the broadcast Jim Lafferty's old friend. He's in Los Angeles. He's probably put together more anti-war demonstrations than he cares to remember. Or do you? That's probably not true. You probably do care to remember. Welcome, Jim Lafferty. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. And you and I have certainly marched together a number of times. In fact, I always still remember the time we had to jump some hedges in DuPont Circle during one of the big anti-war demonstrations. Neither one of us knew we could jump that high.
Well, I would hate to have to do it again. I'm glad that... one of the reasons I wanted to get you on the air was that a lot of these demonstrations around the country have just been diminished into a series of commas.
Yeah.
And you helped organize the demonstration in Los Angeles yesterday. And I wonder if you could tell us about it in terms of numbers and whatever.
Yes, absolutely. It was one of the largest demonstrations probably in the history of Los Angeles, and Los Angeles, of course, doesn't tend to have demonstrations the size of Washington or even San Francisco, although yesterday both San Francisco and L.A. had about 50,000 people. Washington, D.C. had, as far as we can tell, at least 250,000 people. It was also very noticeable in Los Angeles yesterday, an influx of some forces and people that you don't necessarily see in the past in our demonstrations here, the broadening, if you will, of the movement, and that's always a very healthy sign. So everybody was very pleased here. The organizers were all very pleased. Those who came to the demonstration seemed buoyed by it. Everybody understands one demonstration does not an anti-war movement make, but I do think we're at a point where we may be at least, as they used to say, Vietnam, when they would talk about the light at the end of the tunnel. I think we may now begin to see that kind of point of critical mass being reached where it becomes difficult for a politician, be he Democrat or she Democrat or Republican, to continue the war. That's what we're striving for at any rate.
Well, Jim, you said in Los Angeles some people came out that probably heretofore hadn't been involved. Like who?
Well, of course, we had the California Nurses Association. They haven't been really involved before. Arnold Schwarzenegger is partly responsible, I think, for helping to politicize them. With the South Central Farmers, which is a group of Latino farmers that have not marched ever before against the war. United Teachers of Los Angeles have taken positions against the war, but yesterday there was a huge contingent of them. Indeed, as you may well know, this is the first time in 50 years that the national AFL-CIO has condemned the U.S. war. And here in Los Angeles, our Central Labor Council did the same and sent a good delegation. Labor's now getting more involved in the anti-Iraq war movement. And of course, a lot of young people here in our city, a good proportion of Latinos and Asians. It was a very mixed group of people. We haven't always seen that in the past. It's spreading. You can feel it, and you can sense it in the public opinion polls, of course, too.
Well, Jim, we're talking with Jim Lafferty, who's one of the organizers of the mass demonstration in Los Angeles. Is it discouraging at all when you read the accounts and it, like, I don't know, I can quickly, here's what let me see if I can find this quickly, this is what essentially all that was reduced to. Yeah. Thousands of people attended smaller rallies in cities on the West Coast, including Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco, and Seattle. We're getting a much better and fuller report from you. Is this discouraging at all?
Well, it is a bit discouraging, and of course, as the corporate media, I don't need to tell your listeners, has become more corporatized, more monopolized. You have the mainstream media not anxious to spread the word that the anti-war movement is growing as big as it is. The LA Times here, I must say, was a little bit fairer to us and gave a reasonably good account. But certainly the Hurricane Rita and what have you provides a possibly understandable, we could debate that at another time, a reason for why they didn't cover the anti-war movement more. C-SPAN did carry the national rally. Air America played a very good role, as did the Pacifica station, so it probably reached more people than usual, but certainly in the mainstream press, I'm getting reports such as you just referred to, that other than Washington, D.C., everything else was just kind of a comma, as you say.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was... As I think you know, I was substitute hosting a few weeks out in Monterey, California, and I know they had a demonstration in Monterey. They had one in San Diego.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea of figures for those cities?
Well, they think they had at least two or three thousand, down in San Diego, which, of course, is a big military town, very conservative city. I dare say, I don't hold me to this, but I suspect it's the largest anti-war demonstration they've had there, at least since Vietnam, if not even then. And we had, for the first time here in Los Angeles, we had buses coming from Phoenix, from Tucson, from Colorado. We had about 20 buses coming from out of state, and we had another 10 or 15 buses coming from some of the outlying counties. That's not happened before in an anti-war demonstration here in Los Angeles. We know over 200 cities had buses going into Washington, D.C. And it's important to note that the Amtrak decided that they had some problems suddenly with why they had to cut service from New York to Washington and from Philadelphia to Washington, stranding, even as the L.A. Times acknowledged today, thousands of people who also wanted to get to that demonstration in D.C.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you go to my website, I just put up a fake Time magazine cover, which says, Bush resigns, the nightmare is over, and actually a little slash across it that says, Cheney begins prison term.
We're way ahead of you. You and I remember this so well, and I think we would both agree, we haven't talked about it yet, that we're really way ahead of where we were in the movement at the same period of time during Vietnam. It took 20,000 body bags then before a majority of the American people were polled as saying they were against the war. We've got 67% now, pretty solidly against the war in Iraq, with happily, sadly, only 1,908 or whatever it is body bags. You've got veterans speaking out from Iraq, speaking out sooner than the Vietnam vets did. You've got Gold Star mothers and families against the war and military families. That didn't happen until much later in Vietnam. As I say, you've got the organized trade union movement in this country speaking out, and indeed they never really did at the national AFL level the way they have now around Iraq. So as history accelerates, so does our movement, which is a good sign. And certainly the work of Cindy Sheehan, certainly the effect of Katrina not being able to take care of our own here at home and having who should be taking them care of them far away doing something that makes no sense to the American people. All of that, I think, as I say, is helping to move this movement towards a period of what we sometimes refer to as kind of critical mass, when it just begins to be impossible for the politicians to ignore it. they shouldn't be ignoring it now. The will of the people is pretty clear now, and yet you have very few voices in Congress in either party saying boo about the war.
Well, we just got to say boo to them a little more. Well, Jim Lafferty, I want to thank you for taking the time and for the report from Los Angeles. And in a way, I mean, I'm certainly pleased to get you on the air, but in a way, it's unfortunate that that people in Detroit can't just turn on the radio or look at their computer or look at the newspaper.
It is true. And give my love and to all the good people of Detroit. It's been a good anti-war town for years, and I'm sure there's still a lot of good fermentation there against this war.
Thank you, Jim Lafferty.
Thanks, Peter.
Appreciate it. Thanks for joining us. Jim, one of the principal organizers of the enormous Los Angeles rally in the Associated Press, one of the smaller demonstrations, as they called it, 50,000. All right, let's go back to our calls. Here is Matt in Grosse Pointe. Hey, Matt, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, this is Matt from Grosse Pointe. How you doing?
Hi.
Basically, wanted to comment on the undercount of the protest in Washington. A buddy of mine and I went to Washington for the demonstration, and we checked the AP wire at about 10 o'clock in the morning, and found out that they had estimated that about 2,000 people had showed up for the demonstration, which was pretty much counter to what we had exhibited, you know, by our eyes.
2,000?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, later on in the evening, as we checked the wires, they said tens of thousands. And I just wanted to say that based on our personal observation, my personal observation had always been there were the demonstrators who had their own count, and there was the government or, you know, whoever who had their own count. I always figured that the count was in between. And after actually being involved in a demonstration, I realized that the count is not in between. It's actually much closer to the,
what,
you know,
the
real.
Yeah, what the organizers.
Exactly. Yeah. I had figured based on, you know, on a first-hand account that there was a 500,000 people there. I don't know if that's accurate, but
well, that's what C-SPAN was giving it live coverage, and they said 500,000 people turned out at the anti-war march in Washington on Saturday that you attended. You know, it is very common to hear people say, well, I take the police estimate and I take the organizers' estimate and I do the average. So if one group says 100,000, like the media does, and the organizers say 500,000, well, I can't even figure what it is, 300,000 or whatever. But I don't know. I've never seen any assertion or any proof that anti-war demonstrators have ever done this. I can't believe that somebody didn't say they had 500 people when there was only 400 or what have you. But there's no pattern of this. And in fact, the organizers of these demonstrations frequently hire airplanes to get grid, or they photograph them with grids and then they can figure it out. So, and also, we know the media are made up of professional liars. We know that the police historically have always underestimated the amount of demonstration. We know that the politicians in power have a vested interest in reducing the numbers. So you can say, well, the organizers have a vested interest in expanding it. But you got to show some proof, and there isn't any.
Exactly. That was my point. That being there for the first time, I realized that the difference is not in between. It's closer to exactly, you know, who organized.
Yeah. Was this the first demonstration you've ever been to?
Yes, it was. It
must have been a hell of a time. Those things are incredible.
It very much was, and I'm very excited to go to another one.
Yeah.
I should say, I hope I don't have to go another
one. Well, that's right. I'll tell you one thing, though, that, you didn't ask for any advice, but find, in fact, maybe I'll get to this in a second, find the media that also reflects that point of view. It's out there. Because if we spend our time watching corporate and right-wing media, it just serves to dispirit us and make us think that no one else thinks like us. Whereas when we go to rallies like that with somewhere between 300,000 and 500,000 people, all of a sudden we are exhilarated, right?
Absolutely.
All right, Matt, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. And let me read this. I'm going to have to leave this line kind of open. If Jay, maybe you can hang it up or something. This is from Matthew. He wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He said, I was in Washington on Saturdays. Peter, we met on the Detroit Riverboat Tour. That was a couple Saturdays ago. And talked about the rally. I've been a listener for over 20 years. Have I been doing it that long? And it was a thrill to talk with you. My daughter and I took a bus from Detroit and attended the rally because they had these organized buses. Like I explained to you, this was the first protest rally and didn't know what to expect. We both found the experience inspiring to be around so many like-minded people. We watched the speakers at the Ellipse until around 2 p.m. and then joined the march. It took us until about 4 p.m. to make it to the White House. We've never been in such a large group of people. We did see some of the counter-protesters. Forget about those. There were the, I don't even want to talk about them. I don't want everybody. You know, these people are this infinitesimal minority. Why are we paying any attention to them? I'm very glad we attended. By the way, I read in the New York Times that the National Park Service no longer provides official estimates for large gatherings in Washington. And Matthew says, I wonder why. I don't know if it's, you know, if you're just going, I wonder why. I mean, if you're actually wondering, it's because they were always catching such hell. People were saying, you're lowballing. Which, you know, they in fact were. Let's see. Here's what I wanted. I got this email here. This is actually Dan's listening and wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, hey, Peter, this week they started a Christian club at my high school called The Search. This just makes me mad. I bet they wouldn't let me start an atheist club. Give it a try. You know, I mean, hey, this is coming up again about the Pledge of Allegiance with under God in it being illegal. But let's see. Steve wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com and sent this very well-written, very thought-out, long rebuttal to one of these right-wingers that's on Foxhole News. And I wrote him back, excellent letter, but it'll probably fall on deaf ears. It hardly seems worth your time or emotions to watch these liars and psychos or write them letters. My advice, which you didn't ask for, take a walk or read a book. These people are toxic. That's what I wrote. He wrote a good letter, very thoughtful to them. But Steve wrote back, you're 100% right, but if I leave it alone and don't challenge these people, it just sits inside me and festers. It's like I have to release it. It's not so much that I'm trying to convince them. I don't know. I look forward to your show. I always take a 3-hour nap, set the alarm for 10 minutes before the start, then listen to the whole thing. That way I'm not too tired at work on Mondays. Yeah, I know about the White Rose Society. WhiteRoseSociety.org is where you can get archives of this program going back pretty far. Also, it's iPodded. It's podcasted through WRIF.com. And this whole show is repeated on RadioPower.org at, how come I don't remember these things? Wait a minute. I may have written, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on RadioPower.org. Whew. All right, let's get some more calls on the air. Oh, boy, Steve's been waiting a long time. Steve, thanks for waiting. I appreciate it. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing, Peter?
Doing great, thanks.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I've been waiting a long time. I lost one call, and then I got back through again.
Good, what's up? You're on the air.
I guess my only concern is to, I understand I'm not a real political person, but politics is necessary for balance. But my concern comes from the bashing of our president. Yeah, he does have a tough job. I don't agree with everything he says or does, but I just have this question for you, Peter.
Sure.
Who does he belong to, and who is it that rises a king up and sets a king down?
The corporations.
Pardon me?
The corporations?
No, it's God Almighty. And
really?
You can look through history. I don't care how religious you are or what your political or religious stance is. All throughout history, God's always risen up a king, and he's always set him down because the people desired a king because the manipulation that's possible with when a king's in office.
Yeah.
Now, the very thing that I'm going to say here is that no matter who's in office at this time, God's word will come to pass.
You think so, huh?
And the wars that are going on are because they're spoken by the power of the Holy Spirit, and it will happen. And if you look at Israel throughout all history, even before this nation was founded, anytime Israel displeased God, God allowed their enemies to rise up against him.
Well, listen, you know, you say you don't know much about politics, but you're talking politics and you're preaching. So I don't buy any of that, but thanks for calling. That's in another realm, right? It's not what we're talking about. So, yeah, you're right. It was a little rude to him. Here's Damon from Redford. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead. Hello?
Here's Damon from Redford. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead.
What are you next?
Hello?
Hello. Can we turn your radio completely off?
Yeah.
Okay.
Turn the radio completely off.
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hello?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air. It's not completely off, but I'm gonna have to like make a count. Okay.
Yeah, turn it off.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just want to talk. I had a few things to say about Republican. I think they're legalized crime.
Okay.
For one thing, I think what everything he says is true.
Who?
Peter.
Oh, you're on the air, and you're talking to me right now.
Yeah, Peter.
Yeah, hey. Okay, you know what? I appreciate you calling, your sentiment and everything like that, but technically it's too tough to go on, so let me just say thank you and have a great night, and thanks for the endorsement. 313-298-WRIF, that leaves two lines open, so grab them if you want to say something. It's Nick from Dearborn. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Doing good.
I just want to talk, you said something earlier about, propaganda, Bush uses propaganda. Well, I'm going to say right now that I'm a moderate, all right? I'm not right-wing, I'm not left-wing, because, honestly, I listen to the right-wing. They say some pretty ridiculous things and some just things that have no merit and you can't follow it. And the left-wing does the same thing. And as far as Bush using propaganda, I believe you're absolutely right. You know, he talking points, things you just get into the American heart and just make him believe whatever he says, regardless of what it is and how crazy it is. And you say use the comparison to obviously the Third Reich. You know, they did the exact same thing. And the thing of it is that it worked. And what the left doesn't have is a leader, a figurehead to get behind. I mean, Bush, I don't think he's actually in power, to be honest with you. I mean, he's just too stupid. Okay, the Republicans aren't so stupid to let this guy run the country. There's someone, just telling him, feeding him lines. But the thing is, he's that American guy that, like, the Americans can see and believe and like, semi-feel good about. I mean, not having all this crap sitting in the fan. It's like, they're kind of waking up and getting slapped in the face. And I think it's a good thing. But honestly, what the Democrats came with last election was a zombie. And then in voting for an idiot or a zombie, I think the average American is going to go with the idiot. Because honestly, I use the example of look what's on TV nowadays, and the people are watching it. And I think honestly, the average American isn't that bright. And
I mentioned Mark Twain earlier. He said once, consider the intelligence of the average man and realize that 50% are even stupider.
Yeah, that's right.
But we shouldn't be elitist now, because it really has turned out that the American people as a whole, with the exception maybe of this kind of fascistic remaining third, have figured out the deal. We're being lied to. We're being scammed. Our pockets are being picked. And the people that are supposed to protect us aren't doing it, and instead are just taking our money.
No, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, I'm not trying to say, we should, herd the American people like cattle. But you have to find a leader that can speak at their level. You know what I mean? Like, Bush honestly speaks at a level that the lowest common denominator can understand. And when you get a leader who, no matter how good his intentions are, no matter how great his ideas are, if the American can't understand it, he's not going to vote for him and he's not going to follow him.
Any suggestions for who that leader could be?
Oh, I mean, that's up to the Democrats, man. I mean, I'll give you the ideal person that I would vote for to be president is the person who comes up on stage in front of the microphone and says that he doesn't want to be president because he doesn't want that power, but he thinks that he's the best person, and he leaves it at that. And he tells you what he's about, and he lets you agree with him or disagree with him.
You get that guy from West Wing. I can't remember. I haven't seen it in so long. Maybe there's a presidential race going on, and he wants to be the first person of Mexican-American ancestry. I mean, I don't know. This is joking. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. We'll keep looking for that leader. Although Bob Dylan said and sang really long time ago, don't follow leaders, watch your parking meters. Let's stick with the Knicks. Here's Nick from Warren. Nick, hi. You're on the air. Welcome to the broadcast.
This is Rick.
Rick?
Yeah.
Oh, well. Yeah, it is Rick. It is Rick. Oh, you're right.
Peter.
Yeah.
You're awesome.
Well, thank you.
I wrote some notes down. I don't know if it would make any sense to you, but why has the United States become the land of opportunity for everyone except the people that built it?
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking basically not as far as the U.S., but Michigan. Well, we're a minority here now.
Well, we're what do you mean we're a minority?
Well, minority used to pertain to blacks.
Yeah.
Blacks are not a minority anymore.
What do you mean by that?
You
mean numerically?
What's the opposite of minority?
Majority.
Majority.
Yeah. You think people of African descent, the African Americans, are in the majority in Michigan?
No. No. The opposite.
Yeah, they're a minority.
We used to call them a minority.
Now we call them the majority?
Yeah, no. Oh, man.
All right, this seems a little confused. Think it out, call us back. I got to do a break.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
It's Morty, the American Equity Market Spokesdog here. With interest rates all over the place these days, I've learned that chasing a great rate is like chasing your tail. It can be fun, but in the end, you're exhausted and you look a little foolish. Meanwhile, your house has just been sitting there. Get it working for you. Refinance, take out cash to pay off credit cards, or make some home improvements with a great rate from American Equity Mortgage. Like this.
5.25%. Fixed. That's right. A low fixed rate of 5.25 at American Equity Mortgage. Call 888-229-7699. 5.25 fixed rate could be here today. Gone tomorrow. 888-229-7699. APR 54691. Rate subject to change.
See? With American Equity Mortgage, you don't have to chase around for a great rate, which is good because your neighbor shouldn't have to witness that. Visit AmericanEquity.com.
Every successful career has a beginning. Have you started yours yet? Turbocharge your opportunities by calling ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-903-1919. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. If you have an interest in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design, they teach skills that many employers look for. Most programs provide a hands-on education and can help you build your knowledge base and technical skills. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Develop technical skills at an ITT Tech and discover a whole new world of opportunity. Call now for a brochure at 1-800-903-1919. That's ITT Tech, 1-800-903-1919. 1-800-903-1919.
It's party time. Get a real feel of erotic image featuring Michigan's hottest male and female strippers.
Erotic image.
Add a stripper to any party and watch your party come alive.
Erotic Image Strippers delivers the sexiest and most seductive entertainers right to your doorstep.
For your next bachelor, bachelorette, birthday, or any party occasion, give the gift that unwraps itself. Call Erotic Image Strippers at 888-41-STRIP.
Explore Erotic Image at eroticimage.com, the official home of the Erotic Image Dream Girls, the incredible hunks of Men in Motion, and those naughty, awesome twosomes, the wild, girly girls. Turn your party into a bash and try a party appetizer to kick off your next gathering. Their costumed host, hostess, and bartenders will cater to your guest of honor and dazzle your party. Now at Erotic Image, male and female models for any and all events.
Call, click, or visit the Erotic Image Cyber Showcase. View Erotic Image's strippers, check their prices, and place your order online.
Call Erotic Image at 888-41-STRIP. That's 888-41-STRIP.
Erotic Image, where image is everything.
Hey, Napoleon, where are you going?
I'm going to Waterloo to meet my enemy.
enemies.
But you could get defeated if you go there.
Who cares? It's over for me anyway. My wife, Josephine, she's divorcing me. She has this tough lawyer who wants to take everything. My palace at Versailles, all the fancy medals I win.
Oh.
Even my faithful horse, Pierre.
Well, there's no reason for a man to lose his home, his children, his money, or his self-respect.
Oh?
Now, Adam is here to protect you. Adam is the American Divorce Association for Men. They're a group of highly qualified divorce attorneys and counselors who will defend the rights of men in any divorce case.
Ooh.
Adam will answer your questions about divorce at no charge. Call the American Divorce Association for Men.
Hello, this is Napoleon the Great speaking.
Who is that, you nappy darling?
Josephine, what do you want from me now?
Adam is handling your divorce.
Yes, so?
Well, maybe after you conquer the rest of Europe, we could have lunch. I mean, it's nothing to lose your head over.
Call Adam at 248-356-ADAM. That's 248-356-ADAM.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. Jean Shorts Inventor.
Mr. Jean Shorts Inventor.
People insisted that jeans were just pants. Apparently those people underestimated your out-of-the-box thinking.
A fashion trailblazer.
Casual enough for a barbecue. Formal enough for a family reunion. Your multidimensional creation handles both duties with ease.
You just said duty.
And what should we call your groundbreaking achievement? How about Jorts?
We really love your Jorts.
So crack open an ice cold Bud Light, Mr. Jorts Inventor. If fashion's a war, you're fighting dirty.
Mr. Jorts Inventor.
Bud Light Beer, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri.
The Marshall Fields Day of Music is back, featuring 35 free musical acts, family concerts, kids' activities, and the DSO Idol Contest. Experience special performances by Robert Bradley's Blackwater Surprise.
Keep running down the track.
Question Mark and the Mysterians.
2 minutes here, drop for one heart.
Black Murder.
Oh.
Wall of Denial. Jazz Head. Omari Taylor and Friends. And a special free performance by the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. It's the Marshall Field's free day of music starting at 5 p.m. September 30th and rocking nonstop for 24 hours at the Max, the Max M. Fisher Music Center. For more info, call 313-576-5111. That's 313-576-5111 or at DetroitSymphony.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment of the show this Sunday evening. Man, I'm going to check out that that Marshall Field's 24 hours of free music. A lot of great bands, a lot of different genres. I mean, people are doing that now, you know, mixing all this stuff together. Let me get you a few emails real quickly. Calltalkyes at yahoo.com. My website, peterwerbe.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com. And BuzzFlash. Another website I would advise you to go. Actually, I'd advise you to go there before mine. BuzzFlash.com. They have Jeb Bush as the GOP, in other words, Republican hypocrite of the month. And they say, why did Jeb Bush's kids keep getting arrested instead of joining the army? That's a pretty good question, I'd say. Rich is listening in Clarkston. He writes, once again, I agree with you. And right at the beginning of the show, I was saying I'd been to New York City during this last week. He says it's an amazing place, but he also doesn't know how people live there. He grew up in western New York, but moved to Michigan. He says, my wife and I visited Manhattan in late June for the first time. We plan to go there again sometime. I wrote to you a month ago or so about a T-shirt I bought in Times Square. Oh, yeah. The Bush Senior Bush Junior Dumb and Dumber shirt. And Rich says he's building a collection of anti-Bush shirts. You could probably spend your entire paycheck on what's out there. I love to wear them in common places in the hopes that some fool will try and call me out on it. Come on, let's be a little peaceful here, Rich. Keep up the good work. Love the show. The best one I've seen so far, a friend of mine just bought, I think, 8 shirts, all that say, build levies, wait a minute, make levies, not war. That's right. You know, instead of make love, not war. Make levies, not war, talking about where all this money is gone. Dan is listening in Daytona Beach, says he's my libertarian friend. When I came to Michigan a couple of weeks back, I went on to New York. While I was at a rest stop in, on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, I saw an interesting bumper sticker. Who would Jesus bomb? Who would Jesus bomb? And he says, I thought it was a typical protester bumper sticker. Then I saw the driver of the car, a young female. I asked her where she got her sticker. She said she got it from her seminary. Dan says, that shocked me. It's nice to see Christians against the war. And many are. These guys in office claiming to be Christians are a bunch of phonies. And Who Would Jesus Bomb is also a song by David Rovics, R-O-V-I-C-S. You can go to davidrovics.com, download it for free. I think we got one more that I want to read here, and then we'll go back to your calls. from the last callers, Shelby, who's the webmaster of radiopower.org, that's kind enough to stream this show and then repeat it at radiopower.org on, listen to my voice, what's happening here, on Monday at 9 a.m. and 6. Hold on. Sorry. She writes, is everyone stoned in Michigan tonight? As much as possible, Shelby, as much as possible. All right, well, let's go back to our calls, and we'll take Luther and Troy. Hi, Luther. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. It's good to hear your voice, sir.
Thank you. Welcome.
I tried to make it out to D.C., but the costs prevented me from doing so. I had trouble finding a place locally that I could go to, and I checked Macaui, and I checked United for Peace and Justice. Was there someplace else I could have looked for finding a local
place to stay?
O'Reilly.
There was. I didn't hear anything about that. There was one in downtown Detroit at, I think, at 12:30 on Saturday. No one's called to give a report on that. And there was one in Livonia.
Okay.
You know where you can find out all this mysterious information?
Other than your website?
No, I don't know where. Yeah, you can go to, actually, you can go to my website. If you go to the calendar, then that also hooks you into, like, the Michigan Emergency Committee Against the War in Iraq, to the Michigan Committee in Human Rights and all that stuff. So, yeah, it's a good place to start.
I didn't check your calendar, and next time I will check your calendar. And
okay.
I hope that the reconstruction that's following these two hurricanes doesn't cost as much as the war, because that's going to really hurt us all.
No, it is going to cost that much. For one thing, this is nothing that Bush is opposing. I mean, he said it's going to happen because that's $200 billion more for his rich contractor buddies.
The myth of fiscal conservatism with Republicans, I think that's about dead.
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely think so. All right, Luther, thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. And coming at us next is the mystery guest. I don't have a name up here. Hi, you're on the air. Who's this?
Hello, Jim.
Jim it is?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
Okay. Yeah, but, I mean, you don't seem to present both sides of it, you know. I mean, on the basic level, I would say because, you know, what is the alternatives? Because man basically destroys himself. They don't, you know, they don't have leadership. They don't take, you know, the role of leadership either. You know, the basic man. You know, and as opposed to leadership, I mean, they're going to take, you know, command over you if you don't, you know, like take some direction over your own life.
Who's the they we have here?
You know, the government will take, you know, will basically make decisions for you.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's what people are okay with that, it seems like. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, people are kind of willing to just let others govern them because they're in this society, we're kind of told the people that get up there to the highest point of corporate wealth or political power are people that at some level will take care of us. But that's kind of an illusion, I think, that we have to divest ourselves of, and I agree with you. We have to become actors in history. We have to become people that take responsibility for our own lives and look a little closer and look beyond just the glittering images on television. And if we don't want to be looted, as we are by the corporations, if we don't want our kids to be in debt, we have to see what this political leadership in Washington is doing. And if we don't, we're just suckers. We're just there for the con games. All right, thank you. Appreciate your remarks. Let's see. Yeah, where is this now? Here's Ron. Are you in Northport or North Lake Point?
Oh, good morning.
Hi.
Well, I'm from North Lake Port, Michigan, by Port Huron.
Really? Never even heard of it.
You heard of Port Huron, I'm sure.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, just north of that, about 5-6 miles.
Yeah, what's up?
Okay. But, just fed up with everything, you know, with the government and all the pork belly spending and the taking away from the old people, the food and the Medicare and everything else. I mean, I'm a blue-collar worker, you know, and I just have a regular mortgage and, you know, just a truck payment, and I have to work all this overtime. Like, I worked 12 hours today, you know, yesterday, and you have to work more and more just to get ahead.
Even sure.
Two incomes is just terrible.
Well, I've said before that in the 1880s, working people were shot down in the streets of Chicago for the eight-hour day. People died to get the eight-hour day, and it's just slipping away, particularly from working people. But it's true with middle-class people as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I don't even know. I don't even think I'm middle-class. I'm probably below that. You know, I'm like maybe $40,000 a year or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and my wife's a bus driver. And it's just, you know, we struggle. Kids in college now, and, you know, one thing and another. It's just... like you hear of things of these government people spending money to build a roadway and a bridge to an Alaskan island where you know there's really they should use the money for like the levees or something, you know.
Sure. Sure.
You know, and you know, people trying to impress their laws upon you daily, it seems like it's getting towards its communist state. You know, it seems like a lot of times.
Well, we are just waking up, so nothing's going to be fixed or changed tomorrow. And the people that the big shots, the wealthy, the powerful, they you know they think they can always fool us in one way or another. I mean, at some points in history, they try to buy us off, which is probably the least bad way to go. But after a while, they even tire of that. Like, you know, our parents and grandparents, depending on how old we are, during the 50s, if you worked in a factory and your wife had a part-time job, damn, things were good.
Things were good, but we're so taxed, and just like it's the health of people, I think, is diminished due to the stress of daily trying to survive. Just a lower class person.
Sure. Well, let me just say something real quickly about taxes. The problem with taxes is, first off, the majority of people aren't being rewarded fully for the amount of work that's being done. Secondly, the amount of taxes, the taxes that we pay, don't go for what it should. I mean, first and foremost, as you and I. Sorry, kind of interrupted you, Ron, that
right.
It should go for the health of our country, which means that, like every other modern industrial country, we should have a national health program where we don't have
right.
to pay through the teeth to stay healthy.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that and, like, the lotteries and stuff like that. Now, a lot of this money, where does this go when we have so many schools closing?
I never did get that. I thought, you know,
didn't get it either, you know.
We waste tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars out of our pockets on this lottery, and it was supposed to make for schools, and the schools, they're getting more kids in the classrooms. Well, see, this is what I was getting at, though. We are finally waking up. We figured, you know, we've got enough to do working, taking care of our families, having fun, and doing all that. We don't want to spend all of our life, you know, with politics. But suddenly, because as a people have turned our attention away from the political system, these cutthroat robbers are fleecing us all.
Now, do they have a pipeline going in through Iraq now, a new one, since our military is there?
No. I mean,
I've heard this rumor. It's like it wasn't there before, but now we're there, it's there, that we're maybe getting some oil somehow.
No, it's not there. They keep trying to get some oil out of there. In fact, there is some oil revenue coming, but these pipelines are just sabotaged every other day. So what the United States is doing they're paying tens of millions of dollars to Iraqi tribesmen to guard it. So on one hand, they may get some oil out of there, but we are paying the security guards essentially for the oil companies through our tax dollars.
Now, how come with this oil can't we get some reimbursement back from that country after all of all this garbage is said and done? I mean, through the oil?
I don't know. Yeah. You would think so. That was what another one of the lies that Bush said, that the whole cost of the war was going to be paid by oil revenues that we take. Well, that hasn't exactly gone like that.
More or less we'd have to take.
Yeah. Well, Ron, I think things are a-changing, so let's...
I hope so, because I seem to work my life away with no fun, you know.
Yeah,
that's
not... Yeah, this is the 21st century. We shouldn't be having to do that. It's not the 19th century.
All of us, yeah.
All right, thanks
all
a
right.
lot.
Love your show.
Thank Goodbye. You so much, Ron. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Here is Billy from Grand Blanc. Billy, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
Doing great, thanks.
It's a good tough call tonight, but I actually had a question for you.
What's that?
I've heard you talk about some things in Turkey, ethnic cleansing even on the Kurds, who are supposedly our biggest friends in Iraq, and we're forcing them into an Iraq that doesn't want them and that they don't want, instead of trying to give them their own independent state. But I just heard you mention things that we funded Turkey to do to the Kurds, and wanted more information on that.
This must have been from quite a while ago.
Was, but I never actually got through to ask you, and it's still been bugging me.
Well, the Turks fear an independent Kurdistan. The Kurds are in northern Iraq, in Iran, and in Turkey. And there's been this independence movement on the part of the Kurdish people for a long time. They essentially have had an autonomous state in northern Iraq since the first Gulf War. And they're very jealous about guarding their autonomy because they have something. There's no war up there to speak of. I mean, there has been some bombings and all, but mostly it's life goes on with political parties. They have newspapers that are free to report whatever they want. Turkey says that if there's any move to make an independent Kurdistan in northern Iraq, they will invade to stop it because they're so fearful that the Kurds of Turkey would try to, as they have been in the past, agitate to join that. So I don't think I ever said that. What did you say, that they were doing ethnic cleansing? I don't think I ever said the Turks were doing.
I was trying to remember because I didn't think I heard you right.
No.
I just thought I heard somebody say that we funded the Turkish military.
Well, we do that. And then they do use it to carry out these massacres of Kurds at different times. Yeah.
That's what I was wondering
yeah.
about.
I mean, if you took back the military support of Egypt, Israel, Jordan, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, certainly, even Bush could have given away tax breaks to the wealthy, and we still would have had a surplus. But that's what I was saying to Ron before you, that we don't keep this all in focus. And with our personal money, I mean, we make decisions, right? We say, well, you know, that restaurant dinner's cost, if I go there with my wife or my girlfriend or whatever, it's going to cost me $80. I'm not going there. So you're very attentive to that. And you say, let me see, I want to buy a car, and yeah, I can afford a Taurus. I can't afford a Cadillac, so I'm going to buy the Taurus. But when it comes to how our government takes our money out of our pocket and then spends it and essentially gives it away to these other countries, mostly for military, it's hardly ever for humanitarian stuff or to help countries out of poverty. It's almost always to build up war machines, which means there's going to be more wars, and we're paying for it. So
terrorism, I honestly do. Like, look at Egypt. The leader of the 9/11 bombings, he was from Egypt, who we fund, but here it's because we're funding the upper class of these countries, it's creating a huge division in the classes. So we have these rich people that have money, and either they have so much money that they're looking for a cause in their lives, and terrorism is a cause they can join, or poor people who have nothing to live for anymore.
Yeah, you got it. Thank you, Billy. Appreciate it. I was in a taxi cab in New York, and you know, they have the person's name, and the name of the driver, this was his name, Islam Muhammad. And I thought, boy, this guy probably has a lot of problems flying, Right? It's David from Pontiac. David, you're our last caller. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, how's it going today? I was just kind of curious. There's really kind of interesting how America has shifted over the past 200-something years.
Uh-huh.
Because if you look at it, when it was set up as an experimental government known as a constitutionally protected republic. It has since been known now as a democracy. I do believe, yes, we are awake, and yes, we are making changes. It will take a little bit, but what I'm wondering is what it's going to go to.
Well, we have to have some sort of vision. I mean, right now, people are retreating. Many people are, I don't think everyone appreciate me saying this, but a lot of people are retreating into sort of this religious revivalism. And I'm not talking about everybody who's a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim or anything like that, but the people that really start getting into this super fundamentalist thing. I mean, the way, and religious revivalism always occurs and always has occurred in every country and in this country when the way forward gets lost. The people don't have a vision. Bush's father said what? You had to have the vision thing. Bush Jr., he's got a vision thing, a world of war, a world based on oil, a world that everyone is subservient to the corporations. But we've got to come up with an alternate vision. I mean, I have on my website, it says another world is possible. So we don't have to live like this. We don't have to live with the ultra-wealthy 400 or 500 men controlling half the world's wealth while billions of people are starving and suffering from disease and all of that. I mean, there is a possibility of changing this world fundamentally, but the people at the top aren't going to do it. They're happy as hell with the way things are, and they just sort of ignore all the poverty and misery and disease and what have you. So we've got to kind of move things forward, that's for sure. Let's see here. Do I have time for one more call? We will. And let's get John in Royal Oak real quickly. John, hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, Peter, I just got one quick thing to say.
Sure.
For the guy that couldn't take the hint earlier about trying to find a president, Peter Werby for president, you got my vote, man.
Okay.
I'm sure all your listeners will agree.
Well, there's a few. All the rockers in Detroit.
Yeah.
All right, thank you, John. Appreciate it. Actually, I will just read a final email here. It's from Sam was listening online in Pittsburgh, first-time listener. I've been trying to get through on the phone lines for a while now. I gave up. 19 years old, consider myself a liberal. I used to call myself a Democrat, but the Democratic Party is failing me. The religious right is making more progress than I ever expected. I'm a young man looking forward to the future, but I'm very skeptical. This is another problem. I mean, we have young people that are worried, everything from worried to concerned to fearful about the future. And we have older people who aren't wishing they were young. Let's see, I feel as though something big needs to happen to make this country wake up. You're right. I've tried the protesting, but no progress is getting made. You got to have some patience. That's not highly held quality when you're 19. The Democratic Party needs a new leader, someone who will really fight for the working man. What am I to do, Peter? I need some motivation for the future. I saw a poster today from the war protest, and it said, if you aren't outraged, then you aren't informed. I couldn't agree more. But I think we're going to have to leave it at that. Maybe if I get a chance, I'll email you. I don't have any bright ideas. It's easy to figure out what's wrong. All we have to do is wake up, open our eyes, and we see all of that. On the other hand, actually trying to create something that alters things dramatically, we're gonna have to move forward on that a little slowly. All right, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. A couple of good interviews ahead. Stay tuned for that.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. Another WRIF concert.
System of a Down live. System of a Down, this Thursday night, Joe Louis Arena. Their new album, Mesmerize, in stores now.
Everybody's going to the party, have a real good time.
With special guest, the Mars Volta. System of a Down and the Mars Volta. This Thursday night, Joe Louis Arena.
Yeah!
Yeah!
No, they can't. System of a Down and the Mars Volta. Don't miss it. Get your tickets on sale right now at all Ticketmaster locations, the venue box office, or log on to cellardoor.com. System of a Down, live.
Hi, I'm David Hall from Rock Financial, and I know it's late, but rockfinancial.com is the perfect late-night option for folks looking at mortgage options. How about interest-only options, even for first-time homebuyers? Well, you can find them at rockfinancial.com. Maybe you have questions about down payments, private mortgage insurance, closing costs. Our website can help you get the answers that you need at rockfinancial.com. And the mortgage experts at Rock Financial, well, they provide expert advice for first-time homebuyers, folks ready to refinance. Maybe you're looking to step up to your second or third home. rockfinancial.com is a great resource. You can get into a new home for little or no money down. If you go to rockfinancial.com and check out your options, you'll know a lot more. Most monthly payments for first-time homebuyers are less than rent payments. So if you go to rockfinancial.com, explore all your options, you'll find out. It's late night. It's perfect time to go to rockfinancial.com.
Rock Financial is a Quicken Loans company and equal housing lender.
Centerfold Lounge, Detroit's sexiest adult entertainment club, is celebrating their 20th anniversary. That's 20 years of hot ladies, rock and roll, and fun. Come celebrate with 20th anniversary specials, a complimentary buffet, buckets of beer for $20, and two for $20 dances. Take pleasure in great giveaways as you dance to the beats of the house DJ. Centerfold, with the greatest ladies, music, and light show. Bachelor and bachelorette parties are always welcome. NFL Sunday, Centerfold's opens at noon with great food, including pizza and wings, dollar drafts, and $3 bottles. Get there early to catch the game on the big screens. Centerfold Lounge opens 7 days a week at 2 p.m. on John R. One block south of 8 Mile Road. Call 313-892-7333 for more details. Centerfold Lounge, 20th anniversary and NFL action. Football, buffets, hot ladies, rock and roll, and big specials.
Center of attraction.
When my son started having behavior problems, the total transformation techniques were like the instruction manual on how to deal with him. We got immediate results.
Ever wish your kid came with an instruction manual when he's disrespectful, defiant, or even abusive? Do you know how to fix it? I'm behavioral therapist James Lehman, and I'll show you how to change your child's behavior right now with the total transformation. The program then helps you fix every behavior problem under the sun. Defiance, backtalking, lying, acting out in school, even problems with ADD and ADHD. There's no screaming, no fighting, no frustration. The Total Transformation is the program I've used for over 30 years to solve even the worst behavior problems. Your child will listen to you again, and you'll get peace and sanity back into your home. I guarantee it.
Call now and get How to Turn Your Child's Attitude Around in 1 minute or less free with your order. 1-800-325-2185. 1-800-325-2185. Call now. 1-800-325-2185. 1-800-325-2185.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WR.
World's finest musicians as they bring their passion to Tchaikovsky's powerful piano concerto. DSO trombonist Randy Hawes.
He really wrote what was in his heart, from sadness to love and ecstasy, excitement. It's all there in Tchaikovsky's music.
Tchaikovsky's spectacular Piano Concerto No. 1 has become one of the most popular musical pieces of all time. Experience this legendary Tchaikovsky masterpiece performed by piano virtuoso John Kimura Parker. Plus, Shostakovich's moving depiction of the struggle between politics and art, the timeless Symphony No. 5. Be there Thursday, September 22nd through Saturday, September 24th for Tchaikovsky's powerful piano concerto and experience the passion, the power, the performance of the DSO. Tickets are going fast. Call 313-576-5111. That's 313-576-5111 or at DetroitSymphony.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you, as always. You know, most of our attention, understandably so, has been on Katrina and the relief efforts and who's responsible and all of this. And still, the ongoing misery in the Gulf region. our Gulf region this time. Also, there's the ongoing misery of the Gulf region in the Middle East as well. But as some of you may know, there was just an event that occurred in New York City, the United Nations World Summit. It took place September 14th through the 16th. And as we record today on Monday the 19th, General Assembly is meeting. Joining me is Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis Bennis has been a guest on this show any number of times. She's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, and she's the author of the forthcoming book, Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the United Nations Defy U.S. Power. Phyllis Bennis, welcome back to the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks, Peter. Glad to be with you.
How do we look at the United Nations? So there's always, on one hand, this idea that the United Nations is the implacable enemy of the United States, and at other times people say it's just a tool of U.S. foreign policy. How do you look at the United Nations?
Well, I think the irony is, it's interesting that you began this by talking about the devastation that's been created by Hurricane Katrina. And certainly what we're seeing is absolute devastation on a really unprecedented scale. But one of the things that's so interesting was that on the eve of the UN summit, you actually had a situation in which the U.S. for the first time was relying on UN assistance, very direct kind of disaster assistance that poor countries around the world have relied on many times before, but that the U.S. has always claimed it doesn't need. It doesn't need the UN. It doesn't have to rely on the UN. And on this occasion, not only UN direct assistance from the Office of Humanitarian Coordination was made available to the U.S., who desperately needed that kind of assistance, but more than 50 countries around the world, UN members, offered and were taken up on their offers for all kinds of aid, ranging from and including, and this is where we get to a rather shocking reality that the United States, the wealthiest and most powerful country in the world, is forced to take donations of $25,000 from Sri Lanka, still in the midst of recovering from the tsunami, $1 million from Bangladesh, one of the poorest countries in the world. These are the countries that are now offering assistance to the people of the United States. Why? Because our government was not able to respond in a serious way, because the National Guard troops and the rescue helicopters and the amphibious vehicles were all in Iraq. So the role of the United Nations in moments like that has become very clearly and sharply defined in the United States in a way that it rarely does this overtly. What we saw in response to that, of course, was the new UN ambassador, John Bolton, arriving at the UN 3 weeks before the summit and essentially throwing a huge monkey wrench into a very carefully crafted year-long effort to reach international consensus on a document for the summit. The UN, of course, is neither the implacable enemy of the United States, nor is it always a tool of American foreign policy. On occasion, it can be either or sometimes even both of those things. But what we're looking at now is a scenario where the U.S. is really trying to force the UN to take a position supporting the U.S., to stop being an independent international institution and to become what Madeleine Albright once called it, which was that it should be a tool of American foreign policy. So at this moment, the UN is faced with a very serious set of antagonistic approaches, if you will, from the U.S. The U.S. is essentially giving the UN two choices. It's saying you either go along with our strategy for being a kind of weak replicator of U.S. policy directly, or be doomed to irrelevance. Those are the two choices. Now, once before, in the run-up to the Gulf War, to the Iraq War, the U.S. offered the UN essentially that same set of choices. And at that time, the UN said, you know what, we're not going to accept either of those choices. We're going to choose a third way, the way of resistance or defiance of U.S. power. And for that period, when the UN said no to the U.S. drive towards war, you had more credibility to the United Nations than it probably had ever had before, everywhere except in Washington, D.C. That's the option that the UN has now, and the option that I hope that it, in fact, takes.
Well, Phyllis Bennis, just a little parenthesis. I know you were saying about all these kind of 50 countries that had offered aid. I know that Cuba and Venezuela, enemies of the U.S., according to the Bush administration, had offered substantial aid and very fast. Was any of that recognized, taken, or refused?
Well, it's fascinating. You know, the U.S. could not accept the fact that Cuba had offered very specific, targeted kinds of assistance based on the years of Cuba's own experiences of dealing with serious hurricanes. They've, you know, as a Caribbean island, they deal with more hurricanes than the U.S. does on a yearly basis, and they've got it down to a science. And what the Cuban government offered, and they did it first in private, calling in the head of the U.S. embassy in Havana and going to having the head of the Cuban embassy in Washington going to the State Department to make the offer quietly, not for big public affairs. And it was not until 3 days later, when the U.S. refused to respond, did the Cubans go public and say, look, we've been offering this. And what we offered was the following. They offered first 100 emergency room trained doctors, each with a backpack including 24 kilos of the kinds of medicines that they know from their experience are most often needed by hurricane victims. And within 8 hours after that, and they said they could arrive within 3 hours from Havana. They could be on a flight from Havana within 3 hours of the U.S. saying yes. The following day, they would send an additional 500 doctors similarly trained, and the day after that, another 600. So they were offering 1,200 trained doctors to be at work instantly. And the U.S. took the position that they had not made a serious offer, that it was just grandstanding. It was unbelievable. I mean, I wonder if the U.S. government, if George Bush had asked people in New Orleans or in Biloxi, Mississippi, do you want Cuban doctors to come help you out? I have a feeling that they would have been a lot more popular than the Bush administration was prepared to acknowledge.
Well, also, they were bilingual, is my understanding.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
They were English-speaking. It was shocking. I mean, what Cuba was prepared to offer. Venezuela, similarly, had offered doctors, and they've made an additional offer. The Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, spoke in New York two nights ago, and again reiterated his offer to provide medical assistance, particularly eye surgery and ophthalmological care for hurricane victims, as well as free heating oil this winter for the victims of the hurricane. It appears that the U.S. might be considering accepting the Venezuelan offer. They weren't prepared to take the kind of hardcore resistance position that they took to the Cuban offer. But, you know, the other thing, Peter, that's so interesting about this whole process of the international response to Katrina is that beyond the shocking reality of the wealthiest country in the world accepting aid from Bangladesh, the poorest country in the world, you also have the reality of the most powerful military force in the world having to ask for and accept military assistance to respond to the hurricane. So the U.S. ran out of meals ready to eat for firefighters and for hurricane victims. Why? Because all the MREs are in Iraq. So they had to get a shipment of them from Mexico. They ran out of rescue helicopters and had to get helicopters in from Canada. So, you know, the notion of the strongest military force in the world being forced to accept military assistance because it is stretched so thin by the illegal war in Iraq comes right back to the question of why we need an institution like the United Nations to be able to respond at moments like this.
I can see any direction that I was thinking for this interview, Phyllis, is going to be all over the place, but I think we're touching on some very, very important subjects. My guest is Phyllis Bennis. She is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. I get a lot of my information from that website. It's ips-dc.org. Just as a little footnote to the refusal of the Cuban doctors for the U.S. Gulf region relief, the need is so great, as you may know, Phyllis, that there are groups of young doctors and older doctors and medical students that are streaming to that region, forming into autonomous medical groups that have to circumvent FEMA and, in fact, are blocked sometimes from entry into it. And I've heard reports, at least I've gotten emails about it. People have to decide what you know, the how much stock they would put in it. I accept them as real. That guardsmen are sneaking FEMA medical supplies to these local medical groups so they can deliver them to the people. I mean, the need is still so great.
I've heard those same stories, Peter. And again, I can't confirm them independently, but it does seem consistent with the level of bureaucratic sandbagging that FEMA has been responsible for, and this overarching fear of lawsuits. You know, there was another report that FEMA and the U.S. Red Cross refused to play a role in matching hurricane victims, families in particular, with families who were willing to take in boarders, you know, take in refugees, essentially, internal refugees, because they were afraid that if somebody, you know, gave refuge to a hurricane family and a kid stole a wallet or something, that somehow the U.S. government would be held liable. I mean, this is what they were thinking of at this moment of absolute crisis. They were more afraid of anything else of being sued at some point down the line. I mean, it's a nightmarish reality where the agency that has the ultimate responsibility to take care of Americans in this moment of utmost need was worried more than anything else about the political consequences of their actions and how was it going to play in the next election.
All right, let's return to the United Nations. According to the New York Times report on September 18th, the day before when President Bush greeted Secretary General Kofi Annan, on Wednesday he gestured, Bush did, towards John R. Bolton, the United States ambassador, and asked, has place blown up since he's been here?
Yeah, everyone.
So your article, A Declaration of War, which appeared on tompaine.com, P-A-I-N-E, like the great American patriot, tompaine.com. The first line, very provocatively, Phyllis Bennis, you say the Bush administration has declared war on the world. What does this mean?
Well, what that was referring to, this was an article written about a week before the summit, Peter, and it was responding to what John Bolton had done in trying to undermine the carefully constructed unanimity that had been created through this year-long diplomatic process at the United Nations that was aimed at creating a global consensus for a new strategy that would move towards some very modest goals. I mean, we should be clear, these were not grandiose goals of world equality and you know, happiness for all. These were modest goals that involved cutting in half by the year 2015, you know, 10 years from now, cutting in half the number of people living in absolute poverty, meaning living on less than $1 a day per person, a level of poverty that we in this country can really, I think, not even fathom, and a host of other very modest goals. They were known as the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals. And the statement that had been so carefully constructed, no one among these various governments was delighted with it, but they had all agreed to sign on in the interest of global consensus until 3 weeks before the summit began, the highly contested new U.S. ambassador, John Bolton, who had been appointed in a recess appointment by President Bush so that he could avoid the need for a Senate confirmation, which he wasn't able to win, showed up at the U.N. with 700 proposed changes to the document. These were actual demands, and the specific demands were bad enough. It started with eliminating every reference to the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals, claiming that the U.S. had never agreed to sign on to them, despite the fact that, of course, they had 5 years earlier when Bill Clinton was president. But that aside, the significance of it was much greater than the sum of its parts. It was not simply 700 outrageous specific demands at the last minute in a way that was designed to scuttle the whole effort. It was an effort to undermine in a far more fundamental way the capacity and the legitimacy of the United Nations. So it removed all references to future treaties that might be signed, things like the Kyoto Treaty on the Kyoto Protocol on global warming. It eliminated, even more dangerously, references to existing treaty obligations, like the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The entire reference to disarmament and non-proliferation and the obligations of the signers to that treaty completely eliminated, just deleted by John Bolton.
Now,
those deletions were accepted.
They were accepted.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, obviously, John Bolton, who has this reputation as being overbearing, even a bully, I mean, this were some of the charges that were brought up during his Senate confirmation hearings that he couldn't pass. But obviously, he didn't sit down and write these all up. If you're talking about 750 specific objections, this is staff work, right.
And it was not only that it was staff work. This was not about John Bolton. This was not John Bolton running amok, who's going to be reined in by the more responsible ones later or something. This was the Bush administration as a whole. In fact, the excuse that was given by the spokesman for the U.S. mission to the U.N. Was that the reason it took so long was because they had to be vetted in what he called a thorough interagency process, meaning that everybody signed off on it. The State Department, the Pentagon, the White House, and everybody else. This was the Bush administration as a whole. This was not independent running amok by John Bolton, the bully. So when they finally began to negotiate again, you know, the Bolton team made a few sort of concessions on symbols. So they said, oh, well, we can put back the reference to MDGs. And everyone breathed this huge sigh of relief as if that was the main point, as if using the word somehow made it possible to get the world on board and particularly get the United States on board in this effort to cut global poverty in half. But that was certainly not the case. That was purely symbolism to avoid the very harsh assessments that were going on around the world that I put it in the context of the Bush administration has declared war, but writers and analysts and government officials from all around the world were talking about it in similarly harsh terms.
Well, why did these other countries roll over for the U.S.?
Fear. The U.S. remains the biggest economy, the strongest nuclear and military power, the most powerful diplomatic force in all the world. Countries are very afraid of antagonizing the U.S. They're afraid of direct consequences, as has happened before. The most famous example, of course, that people still talk about at the United Nations, although it happened back in 1990, when the tiny country of Yemen, the only Arab country on the Security Council, when the U.S. was trying to get support for its war against Iraq that time, Yemen, along with Cuba, were the only two countries that voted no. And no sooner had the Yemeni ambassador put down his hand than there was a U.S. ambassador at his side who said, that will be the most expensive no vote you ever cast.
Hmm.
And sure enough, 3 days later, the U.S. cut its entire aid budget to Yemen. That precedent, they call it the Yemen precedent, is still being talked about at the United Nations, and there are newer versions of it that happened this time around. So there's a great deal of fear of what the United States will do to countries that that don't toe the line. The real question is whether the kind of coalition that we saw in the run-up to this war against Iraq that brought together some governments, in that case led by France and Germany, but countries like Brazil and Venezuela and South Africa are certainly possible leaders of this. Countries, people's movements all over the world, that time around, of course, symbolized by the giant global demonstrations of February 15th, and the UN itself, both the Security Council and the Secretary General and certainly the General Assembly, together standing up to U.S. pressure and saying no to this demand for U.S. war, in this case, saying no to a U.S. effort to undermine this careful consensus. I think what they should have done would be to say, forget this principle of unanimity or consensus. We're going to have a vote. And if the vote is 190-1, or perhaps 189-2, if Israel stands with the U.S. as it usually does, then that's okay. We don't have to have absolute consensus if we have the overwhelming majority of the countries of the world saying that we are committed to strengthening the United Nations, not to undermining its capacity and its legitimacy.
Well, Phyllis Bennis, of late, and a lot of the imaging of the United Nations came about, as you were just indicating, around the Security Council's refusal to give Bush the go-ahead to invade Iraq, that many American people view the United Nations now very negatively, that it's scandal-ridden, that it's corrupt, that it, well, I guess the same thing, which is it's ineffective, mm-hmm. it's inefficient, and that John Bolton and the Bush administration came in there with a demand for reforms.
Yeah, there's an irony. I think you're right, Peter, that the campaign to demonize the UN that emerged around this so-called oil for food scandal has done a great deal of damage. People have taken uncritically this right-wing campaign, which more than anything else was motivated in response to the earlier UN refusal to endorse the war in Iraq. This was really payback. This was punishment of the United Nations for its refusal to go along with the U.S. war against Iraq. And what they did was to identify some real problems within a very large U.N. project. The Oil for Food project, of course, involved $64 billion over the years of money that went through its hands. And the charge that one U.N. official may have been responsible for stealing $166,000 is a serious charge and should be taken seriously. UN officials should be held to a high standard, and it was appropriate that he be suspended from his job. And if he's guilty, he should be put on trial, charged with it, and if he's convicted, he should be punished. Absolutely right. But the notion that that was somehow indicative either of wide-ranging scandal in the United Nations in terms of money and corruption and that sort of thing, or even that was the most serious problem of the Oil for Food program itself, boggles the imagination. The real scandal, if we want to look for scandals in the Oil for Food program, all we need to do is look at the origins of that program in the sanctions that were imposed on Iraq that led to the deaths of 500,000 children under the age of five because of those sanctions, as Madeleine Albright acknowledged.
Yeah, no,
she, of course, said the price is worth it. That price of 500,000 children was worth it to impose those sanctions. But if we want a scandal, that's the real scandal we should be looking at.
Didn't she say
this was designed as a deflection of blame on the United Nations?
Didn't she say something about you had to make an omelet, you had to break some egg? No, that was Stalin. Never mind. Phyllis Bennis,
you're not making that comparison, are you?
No. We only have about 2 minutes left, and I did want to talk about the speech by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Maybe just briefly, in a minute and a half or so, I mean, there's a lot to talk about here, he got quite a hand at the United Nations, and at least gave half of what the John Birch Society used to say. They used to say, get the U.S. out of the U.N. and the U.N. out of the U.S. He,
That's right.
He signed on, Hugo Chavez did, to the latter.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, there's a number of people and a number of national leaders around the world who have been suggesting that perhaps moving U.N. headquarters to someplace slightly more amenable to the global organization than the United States would be appropriate. I think it's not a very realistic possibility anytime soon. Certainly the U.S. does abuse its host country privileges. This time around, for example, the Cuban delegation were not able to get their visas until just a few hours before they were scheduled to speak because the U.S. simply didn't issue the visas. And there's been those sorts of incidents. The U.S. has refused to issue visas to a number of world leaders on various occasions to allow them to speak at the United Nations. But the much broader problem is the problem of U.S. political and financial and military and diplomatic domination of the world body, which I'm afraid would not be dramatically changed automatically by moving it to a headquarters, whether it be in Geneva or in Caracas. I think that the struggle to reclaim the United Nations is something that both we as people and people's movements, social movements around the world, and that governments, like the government of President Chavez in Venezuela, perhaps with the emerging bloc of independent countries in Latin America that now involves Venezuela and Brazil and Cuba, as well as Ecuador and Argentina and Uruguay, could begin to form the beginning of that kind of a bloc, to link with civil society, with social movements, peace movements, movements to stop war and to end poverty, in a new way, to use the United Nations as a venue for that kind of real struggle, often having to target their opposition to U.S. efforts to drive towards war and new kinds of empire. That's what I think we need to be looking for in the United Nations. Moving the U.N. headquarters, it's a nice thing to think about. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Their website is ips-dc.org. And Phyllis Bennis will have a new book out next month. It's called Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the United Nations Defy U.S. Power. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Peter. It's been a pleasure.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
It's one red-hot night of live local rock and roll, and it's only at Wild Woody's in Roseville this Wednesday night. Wild Woody's and 101 WRIF are giving you the exclusive opportunity to get up close and very personal with Motor City music. One special night at Wild Woody's with the Motor City's own Brian Schramm Band. Join the Doc of Rock, Doug Podell from 101 WRIF. Get in on the special meet and greet with the band members before the show and knock back some Canadian club cocktails with Brian and the band. They're on special all night at Wild Woody's. Heck, you'll be so close, you'll be able to read their tattoos. Oh, and how can we forget, Wednesday nights at Wild Woody's are always ladies' night. Ladies, you walk in the door absolutely free. Don't miss this exclusive engagement with the Motor City's own Brian Schramm Band, hosted by the Riff's Doug Podell, this Wednesday night at Wild Woody's. Wild Woody's on Gratiot, just minutes from 696 or I-94 in downtown Roseville. Call the Wild Line for more details at 586-294-5331.
Wild Woody's.
It's Marty, the American Equity Market Spokesdoc here. With interest rates all over the place these days, I've learned that chasing a great rate is like chasing your tail. It can be fun, but in the end, you're exhausted, and you look a little foolish. Meanwhile, your house has just been sitting there. Get it working for you. Refinance, take out cash to pay off credit cards, or make some home improvements with a great rate from American Equity Mortgage, like this.
5.25%. Fixed. That's right. A low fixed rate of 5.25 at American Equity Mortgage. Call 888-229-7699. 5.25 fixed rate could be here today, gone tomorrow. 888-229-7699. New York 51691. Rate subject to change.
See? With American Equity Mortgage, you don't have to chase around for a great rate, which is good because your neighbors shouldn't have to witness that. Visit AmericanEquity.com.
It's party time. Get a real feel of erotic image featuring Michigan's hottest male and female strippers.
Erotic image.
Add a stripper to any party and watch your party come alive.
Erotic Image Strippers delivers the sexiest and most seductive entertainers right to your doorstep.
For your next bachelor, bachelorette, birthday, or any party occasion, give the gift that unwraps itself. Call Erotic Image Strippers at 888-41-STRIP.
Explore Erotic Image at eroticimage.com, the official home of the Erotic Image Dream Girls, the incredible hunks of Men in Motion, and those naughty, awesome twosomes, the wild, girly girls. Turn your party into a bash and try a party appetizer to kick off your next gathering. Their costumed host, hostess, and bartenders will cater to your guest of honor and dazzle your party. Now at Erotic Image, male and female models for any and all events.
Call, click, or visit the Erotic Image Cyber Showcase. View Erotic Image's strippers, check their prices, and place your order online.
Call Erotic Image at 888-41-STRIP. That's 888-41-STRIP.
Erotic Image, where image is everything.
So here we are, approaching fall, and thinking about those back-to-school memories. You know, my fondest back-to-school memories didn't involve new clothes, notebooks, and those funky Salisbury steaks and tater tots. Hey, this is Screaming Scott Randall from 101 WRIF. If you'd like your back-to-school experience to be a little less back-to-school, then the Spex Howard School of Broadcast Arts is the place to start. Spex Howard teaches you everything you need to get started in radio, television, audio and video production, and so much more. Get hands-on experience. Spend the morning behind the microphone, spinning music, and hosting your own show, designing a light set, writing scripts, learning to edit, direct a program, and no Salisbury steak required, unless you really want them. Yeah, I miss those back-to-school moments, but my job is never dull, and neither will your time be in Specs Howard. Call them at 248-358-9000. Now through October 1st. Just head over and tour the school and all the they have to offer to begin a career that you can be excited about. Classes are forming now. Morning, afternoon, and evening options are available with federal financial aid to those who qualify. The Spence Howard School of Broadcast Arts in Southfield, Michigan. 248-358-9000. This is where you start. It's where I started.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Much for joining me. I've often said, if you've listened to this broadcast in the past, you've probably heard me say it, that Americans' sense of history goes back about a week or so. History began 1 week ago. We actually had such a traumatic experience on September 11th, 2001, that there are people who date to the beginning of history from then. But there's a lot more to history, and most of it on a continuum. When we talk about the Middle East, some of it goes back 1,000 years almost, but that probably is beyond the scope of our current guest and the book that we're going to talk about. Joining me is David Harris. He has a new book called The Crisis, The President, The Prophet, and The Shah, 1979, The Coming of Militant Islam. Militant Islam, something that's on a lot of our minds. David Harris is formerly a contributing editor at the New York Times Magazine, also at Rolling Stone. He's written 8 previous books, The League, Dreams Die Hard, The Last Stand, and we last interviewed him here on the Peter Werby Show. 2001 was the year, Shooting the Moon, about the invasion of Panama. So it's a pleasure to welcome back David Harris. David, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Hey, thanks, Peter.
This,
great to be back.
This is such, and I should say it's the 25th anniversary as of November 4th, 1979, that hundreds of students took over the Tehran-Iran embassy and began what was called America Held Hostage for 444 days. And according to your book, the crisis has set the stage for the ending of the Carter presidency. But the scope of this is so large. Maybe I could, I don't know if this is narrowing it or broadening it, but in your writing, David Harris, is there a connection between your new book, The Crisis, about Iran, and the book we last interviewed you about the invasion of Panama?
Well, only to the extent that they both focus on the on exercises of American power in very different situations. But certainly that question of who we are and how we behave towards the rest of the world is at the center of both books. And in the case of The Crisis, this is really a book that talks about the roots of our current present tense, you know, that you can't really understand what's going on now if you don't understand where it started. And this is the incident where it really started, where we had our first head-on collision with aroused Islam. And you will recognize any number of the characteristics from there as the ones that have continued to haunt our present tense.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about the origins being in 1979 and the hostage crisis then, and I made allusions to 1,000 years back, obviously, to the Crusades. Is it 25 years, or is there a whole festering, epoch-long history behind all of this as well?
Well, certainly the history goes back, and in this specific case with Iran, that 25th anniversary was really occurred on the 25th anniversary of a previous incident in Iran where we installed the government of the Shah, an absolute monarch who ruled absolutely until he was finally overthrown by a huge public uprising that sent him into exile and set the stage for the hostage crisis to come. But certainly what you said about our memory is true. I wouldn't even give us a week credit on that.
Okay.
About history. I think we're about a 30-second attention span culture, and that we forget what other people's history with us is and what our own history with them is. And that can be extraordinarily limiting at best.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly in this incident, this 444 days of hostage taking, was really a blowback from our first exercise in regime change when we installed the Shah in the first place.
And well, I was going to ask you to flesh that out because you use the pronoun we, that this is, in this case, you mean the United States.
I mean the United States.
Yeah. In what manner did, tell us a little, so this is a 50-year history of the overthrow of a democratically elected government. In Iran, this is not normally what we, most Americans, think that the United States does. We're the opposite. We want to install democracy. You're saying 50 years ago. Tell us just a little bit of that story, if you would.
Well, the Shah of Iran was had inherited his throne from his father, who and had held it during the British occupation of Iran during World War II, during which he was basically just a figurehead. After the British withdrew from Iran at the end of World War II, they set up a kind of tripartite government in Iran with a democratically elected prime minister, an elected parliament, and a monarch who shared power, essentially. And that held sway for about 7 years until the prime minister and the parliament decided to nationalize Iran's oil industry.
Oops.
This is in the early 1950s. And the American response to that was that this must be some kind of communist plot and had to be nipped in the bud, and chose to back a military coup against the existing government and install the Shah as not just a figurehead he had been before, but as an absolute ruler, so that by the time the story I tell in this book begins, he is the most absolute ruler in the world. Nobody in their single person had as much power concentrated as he did, and that was a legacy of the United States. The Shah himself said publicly that he owed his throne to God, the people, and the Central Intelligence Agency.
Hmm. And it was what was known, at least colloquially, as a torture state with the Savak, extraordinarily brutal secret police rivaling what was next door in Iraq, if I remember my history correct.
Absolutely.
The book is The Crisis, The President, The Prophet, and The Shah, 1979, The Coming of Militant Islam. My guest is David Harris, and it's published by Little Brown.
Interestingly, Savak, the state security apparatus, was the first foreign aid project the United States directed to Iran to help them organize this state police that could then proceed to torture somewhere around 100,000 Iranians over the years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm reminded of this Franklin Delano Roosevelt quote when he was told, I think it was the Somozas in Nicaragua, but it could have been any number of other dictatorships the United States supported, where someone said that the Somoza was a son of a bitch, and FDR replied, yeah, but he's our son of a bitch. And I wonder, when President Jimmy Carter, known as this gentle man, who this beacon of democracy now, why would he go to Tehran, I believe it was 1977, as you relate in your book, and praise this awful royalist dictatorship?
Well, this was a critical moment in the development of this story, even though it was a year before the Shah, fall of the Shah, and almost 2 years before American hostages were seized. But it was the event that sealed in the Iranian mind that the Shah and Carter were one and the same as political forces, and would dog Carter throughout all of his attempts. The visit to Tehran happened on the spur of the moment during Carter's first the deliberations before Carter's first trip abroad as president. There was a hole developed in the schedule on New Year's Eve in 1977. And they asked Carter, well, where would you like to stop for this day? They only had 24 hours in the schedule to fill. And the Shah and his wife, the Shahbanu, had just visited Washington the month before to be greeted by demonstrations at which tear gas was fired and a whole scene was made. And
this is from Iranian exiles?
Yeah, Iranian exiles, yeah, who were gathered outside the White House when the Shah came. In any case, the Carter said, well, let me think about it, and let me ask Rosalind, who, of course, was the first lady. He went to Rosalind, who had quite liked the Shah and the Shahbanu when they visited, and said, oh, let's go to Iran.
Hmm.
And they go to Iran, and Carter there fell victim to the hyperbole of the classic Southern politician. You know how Southern politicians are. They can't just say something's good. This something has to be great or the greatest. This is not just my friend. This is the best friend I ever had. And in the United States, such hyperbole is taken with a grain of salt and always thought of as simply a rhetorical technique. In Tehran, however, where the words of an American president are parsed up one side and down the other, these words were taken quite seriously, and Carter got up at a state dinner that night during his visit to Tehran and offered a toast in which he described the Shah as the best friend that he had as a world leader and a man of enormous stature who was beloved by his people and created an island of stability etc., etc., etc. This was all said 8 days before what most historians date as the start of the Iranian Revolution against the Shah. But once word of that leaked out, the Iranians were convinced that the Shah and Carter were one and the same. And the Shah himself was quite stunned by the remarks and later described them as the nicest thing any world leader had ever said about him in the entire history of his rule.
Yeah, which was turned out to be, what did W.C. Fields say, the fatal glass of water. I mean, in the same way, it was this had a lot to do with the unraveling of the whole situation. Let's skip ahead quickly. There's there's an uprising against the rule of the Shah. And we arrive in 1979. And with some justification, the attack on the embassy is thought of as horrific, that no one has a right to hold people in the manner that they were. But this wasn't even the first attack on the U.S. embassy in Tehran, was it?
Right. We usually think of this as somehow an exceptional event, but indeed, almost 8 months prior to the actual seizing of hostages, the embassy had first been seized by a group of armed guerrillas. This is in the colossal disorder that descended upon Iran after the fall of the Shah. And a group of armed guerrillas attacked the 26-acre American embassy compound with automatic weapons and seized it and seized the diplomats there and held them for a couple hours before the provisional government of Iran at the time was able to convince them to leave and to return the embassy to the Americans. But while we think of the eventual seizure of the hostages as a great surprise, in fact, in all the internal cables between Tehran and the White House and the State Department in Washington from February of 1979 on, the issue of what would happen to the embassy was first and foremost of all the possibilities. And every time the embassy was asked if the Shah should be admitted into the United States in his exile, they were always responded by saying, if you admit him to the United States, we cannot guarantee the safety of the embassy or of our diplomats.
Hmm.
So we had warning.
Now, everyone's embassy is supposed to be, I don't know, probably need a better word than sacred, but no country has the right to invade the embassy property of another, even in times of war and what have you. Tell us, though, the role of the embassy. I know the Iranians designated it as a nest of spies, and none of this is really, when we look at it, at least in contemporary historical accounts, within both Cold War and oil politics. I mean, it was the Iranians, both as an asset as a country and as a country close to the Soviet Union, were very important.
Right. Our basic tie to the Shah was and to Iran itself had two derivations. The first was that it shared a border with the Soviet Union. And as part of our initial deal with the Shah, he guaranteed us the listening posts that we could use to gather intelligence across the border on the Soviet Union. And second is that Iran was the second biggest oil producer in the world, with oil fields so full that the crude just bubbled up out of the ground, didn't even have to be pumped. And we counted on the Shah to be our friend in the oil councils to try and restrain the price of oil. So those were the two fundamentals that were driving American policy. And certainly that was reflected in the tasks that were conducted at the embassy. It was the second largest embassy the United States had in the world, second only to the Philippines. And it conducted an enormous amount of espionage operations, both towards the Soviet Union and around Iranian issues as well. So certainly its description as a nest of spies, while obviously inflated for the purposes it was used, has a certain amount of accuracy to it.
Mm-hmm. Did the United States retaliate at all against the Iranian embassy in Washington?
No, but they didn't need to. The Iranians basically, except for maintaining a skeletal staff there, have closed that embassy down as it remains that way today, except it does serve a consular function and hands out visas to people wanting to visit Iran. But other than that, the embassy has basically been closed down. There has not been official relations between the two countries since that seizure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, part of what complicates that whole situation as we look back on it was the fact that there was no real established government in Iran during most of this process. We were faced with a country that was in chaos, that was struggling to try and reorder itself and develop a new government. And in the midst of that chaos, a group of 300 students decided to teach the United States a lesson by seizing its embassy. And it didn't, these students did not think that they would be there for more than 72 hours. They had no intentions of holding the hostages for 444 days, far from it. They expected to be there a couple of days to make their point and then to leave. But when they seized the embassy, they were faced with an enormous public response in Iran. All of the various competing factions out in the disorder of Iran immediately pulled together to support what the students had done. Pilgrimages began from all around the country to go and stand outside the embassy. It had such overwhelming public approval that it became the political epicenter of Iran, and at that point it became an open-ended proposition.
Mm-hmm. David Harris is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. He's written The Crisis, The President, The Prophet, and The Shah, 1979 and the Coming of Militant Islam. It's published by Little Brown. You use the phrase in your book about the epicenter of politics for Iran, but the same was true here in the United States. Anyone living during that period remembers each night the network news would open with a banner emblazoned America held hostage day whatever, counting up to 444. And I think you say that the street, in a sense, ruled in both countries. But President Carter was faced with a realistic problem and also a political problem. I don't know if you make that kind of delineation. But how did he and his staff react? Go ahead.
Unfortunately, from Carter's point of view, he kind of cornered himself right off the bat. He was someone who was personally shaken by the taking of the hostages and made giving them back alive his highest priority. But early in the hostage crisis, in the first several days, he was scheduled to take a trip to Canada for some official event. His chief aide at the time, Hamilton Jordan, approached him and said, look, you can't go to Canada in this circumstance. People want you to stay at the White House to manage this crisis that we have on our hands. And Carter agreed to that, canceled his trip to Canada, then took to canceling every other public appointment he had after that so that he could stay in Washington in the White House to manage this. And suddenly he was stuck with his foot nailed to the floor in the White House because he'd created this public precedent that this was far too important to leave Washington over, so he was stuck in Washington during all this, which only intensified the situation rather than diffusing it, which is what it really needed in order to be solved.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the hostages pointed out to me when I interviewed him that when you're bargaining with an Iranian, and here he was drawing on his own experience at the bazaars in Tehran, he said, when you're bargaining with an Iranian, you need to be able to walk away from his stall.
Hmm.
And we could never walk away from their stall. So that this, which only made holding the hostages more important to them, not less, and made it provide them with enormous political leverage, because America was so upset and Carter was so bound by the upset of the larger population that he didn't have a whole lot of options in terms of dealing with the Iranians when it finally got to that.
Well, David Harris, we have two options. Either have a two-hour interview or tell people they're going to have to read the crisis to find out more the details in between here, because I want to, in the time remaining, get
to... It is a fascinating story. Let me assure you.
It is, and I will second that. And I will have links to all of this, plus an interview with David Harris, not the one I'm doing, but another, on my website at peterwerby.com. But bring us up towards the end quickly, because I want to get to your trip to Tehran to do the research. There's a lot of charges that, given all the attempts of the Carter administration to free the hostage, including a failed military exercise, that the release of the hostages was, the refusal to release them before the 1980 election was engineered by Reagan operatives who had already cut a deal with these people, called the October Surprise. Is there truth in this that you find?
Well, certainly that charge has been made over and over again, and was made so often that it was eventually investigated by a joint committee of the United States Congress, which pretty much refuted most of the alleged evidence that had been offered from the American side for this. So there is no proof that this kind of deal actually happened. On the other hand, the Iranians do believe that that was what went on. I interviewed Abolhassan Banisadr, who was the first elected president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and who was in the presidency when all this was supposed to have happened. He recounted to me how he was approached in the summer of 1980 by a mullah who was a relative of the Ayatollah Khomeini's, and told that they had just had a meeting in Madrid with a representative of the American Republican Party who wanted to make a deal about the hostages, and did Banisadr want in on the deal? Banisadr said no, he didn't want in on this deal, and he never heard any more specifics from these guys at all, but he continues to believe to this day that such a deal was cut, and said so publicly in Iran at the time.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so did his foreign minister.
Well, yeah, and the idea that the hostages were released on the inaugural day of the President Reagan coming to power has always struck me as at least a great coincidence. But they were held
on the tarmac waiting for the proper hour after which power had changed hands in the United States.
Huh.
So they would not be released until after Jimmy Carter had ceased to be president.
Right. We have just a precious few minutes left, and I probably didn't leave enough time, David Harris, for you to tell us about your visit to Tehran to write the book, The Crisis. And you actually met with any number of people who had taken part in the hostage taking in 1979 in Iran. What are their feelings 25 years later?
Well, their feelings are mixed. They, as a group, have gone their own political directions, and some of them are deeply involved in the Iranian reform movement that elected the current Hatami government, which is about to be replaced. And a number of them have gone the other direction in Iranian politics and become partisans in the Revolutionary Guard organization and part of the Islamic power structure. So they've all gone in different directions and have their own different feelings. I think that probably a majority of the people that I talked to certainly did not see this as a reason to sever relations with the United States as it has been used as. They wished that they could somehow remake relations and have even attempted on informal ways to do that, but all unsuccessfully. So their feeling was that they were right to do what they did, that they had to do what they did. They explain their violation of diplomatic codes as saying that their own. They were violated far worse than the embassy was violated in the years that the Shah was imposed on them by American power, which of course is their excuse for having overstepped the diplomatic guarantees.
Mm-hmm.
And they were a friendly group, universally, whatever their politics. They treated me with great hospitality, and while I was the only foreign press there for the annual anniversary celebration of the taking of the embassy, and which a crowd of some 5,000 Iranians were outside the embassy chanting "Death to America," and I was out there in the middle of the crowd with my little Iranian press pass, and never ran into any hostility. They would stop shouting "Death to America" and say, "Oh, you're an American," and try and practice their English on me. So.
Hmm.
It's always a more complex situation than it seems in the headlines. But, this is a country that whose relations with the United States are basically frozen in time. We are still back in 1979. There has not been a direct conversation between Iran and the United States since that time. And here we are in a situation where we're both eyeing each other nervously, and there's talk of even war in the air, and we still aren't talking to each other. So that... that all strikes you as extraordinarily weird. It's like visiting the Soviet Union in the 1980s. There is no feedback and forth between the two countries. But they gave me a tour of the old American embassy. I was told I was the first American to visit it since the seizure of the hostages. I'm not sure whether that's accurate or not, but I'll take it. They were quite excited to show me all the rooms where the all the spying apparatus was kept and the like, and still evinced a great suspicion of the United States at best. All factions certainly felt that.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. We've barely scratched the surface, folks. That's why people write books. You just get a little taste. This is an incredible story. It's called The Crisis, published by Little Brown and Company. The subtitle, The President, The Prophet, and The Shah, 1979 and the Coming of Militant Islam. I'll have some links on my website, peterwerby.com. David Harris, thanks for joining me on the show.
Hey, thanks, Peter, for having me.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. Another WRIF concert.
System of a Down live. System of a Down, this Thursday night, Joe Louis Arena. Their new album, Mesmerize, in stores now.
Everybody's going to the party, have a real good time.
With special guest, the Mars Volta. System of a Down and the Mars Volta. This Thursday night, Joe Louis Arena. System of a Down and the Mars Volta. Don't miss it. Get your tickets on sale right now at all Ticketmaster locations, the venue box office, or log on to cellardoor.com. System of a Down live.
This is the one. Four bedrooms, lots of trees, a finished basement, a nice, safe neighborhood.
You know, the neighborhood isn't the only thing that makes you feel safe at home.
Who said that?
It's me, your conscience. Part of feeling secure at home is having the right mortgage company. That's why I'd feel a lot better if we went with Fidelity Mortgage.
Why Fidelity?
Fidelity has specialized in purchase transactions for almost 15 years. So we know they'll find us the best program with the lowest costs. And to keep us safe in the future, Fidelity Mortgage will give us a free home warranty, a safety net for future home repair bills.
That will keep my conscience, you, clear.
Thank you.
Feel secure in your mortgage. Call Fidelity Mortgage today at 1-800-869-0929. That's 1-800-869-0929. Fidelity Mortgage will give you a free home warranty with your mortgage. Call 1-800-869-0929.
Hi, I'm David Hall from Rock Financial. And I know it's late, but rockfinancial.com is the perfect late-night option for folks looking at mortgage options. How about interest-only options, even for first-time homebuyers? Well, you can find them at rockfinancial.com. Maybe you have questions about down payments, private mortgage insurance, closing costs. Our website can help you get the answers that you need at rockfinancial.com. And the mortgage experts at Rock Financial, well, they provide expert advice for first-time homebuyers, folks ready to refinance. Maybe you're looking to step up to your second or third home. rockfinancial.com is a great resource. You can get into a new home for little or no money down. If you go to rockfinancial.com and check out your options, you'll know a lot more. Most monthly payments for first-time homebuyers are less than rent payments. So if you go to rockfinancial.com, explore all your options, you'll find out. It's late night. It's perfect time to go to rockfinancial.com.
Rock Financial is a Quicken Loans company and equal housing lender.
When my son started having behavior problems, the total transformation techniques were like the instruction manual on how to deal with him. We got immediate results.
Ever wish your kid came with an instruction manual? When he's disrespectful, defiant, or even abusive? Do you know how to fix it? I'm behavioral therapist James Lehman, and I'll show you how to change your child's behavior right now with the Total Transformation. The program then helps you fix every behavior problem under the sun. Defiance, backtalking, lying, acting out in school, even problems with ADD and ADHD. There's no screaming, no fighting, no frustration. The Total Transformation is the program I've used for over 30 years to solve even the worst behavior problems. Your child will listen to you again, and you'll get peace and sanity back into your home. I guarantee it.
Call now and get How to Turn Your Child's Attitude Around in 1 minute or less free with your order. 1-800-325-2185. 1-800-325-2185. Call now. 1-800-325-2185. 1-800-325-2185.
Another rip lifter. Another Hemi key winner.
Yes. Am I caller 34?
Yeah, you are.
Excellent.
You got a key.
Sounds great. Yes, sir.
It's the supercharged giveaway on the rear.
From Century Dodge, a member of the Holiday Automotive Group.
And the home of everything that rocks.
101 WRIF.
The rear. Give me fuel, give me fire, give me that which I desire.